You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people matter. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio, Chip Gibbons. Chip Gibbons is Policy and Legislative Counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. His work has been featured in The Nation and Jacobin, and he is a contributing he's contributed to the Henry Kissinger Files, which is forthcoming from Verso Books. Chip Gibbons wrote an article for The Nation just recently called "The Prosecution of Inauguration Day Protesters is a Threat to Dissent." And I am convinced he's right. Chip, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
So what is the story? You know, you think some of these things they're gonna wait a while and then back off the craziness and not really follow through, but they actually are trying to prosecute 200 people for protesting Donald Trump's inauguration. Is this accurate?
Yes. So I too thought early on they would back off the craziness as well. I mean, I was very shocked when they arrested 234 people in an incident of kettling. I mean, that used to happen more frequently in D.C. during the World Bank demonstration days, but the city got sued and they passed laws against kettling. So, I mean, it wasn't a total surprise. But then they turned around and indicted people with felony charges. And I'm like, well, that's not going to last. You can't charge 214 people with felonies from a protest. And then they got a superseding indictment and brought 8 felony charges against 214 people. So they've just continued down this road. It's really, really shocking. So I'll start from the beginning. I mean, on January 20th, as I think most people know, Donald Trump was inaugurated, and a lot of people don't like Donald Trump for a number of reasons. So there was protest during his inauguration. There was a number of events that day, one of which was an anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march. And during the anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march, police alleged that property damage took place nonetheless, in spite of this allegation, instead of taking actions against individuals whom they had, in theory, had probable cause to arrest for this property damage. They continued to follow the march for about 30 minutes before encircling it completely and engaging in what's called kettling. Kettling is an unconstitutional, indiscriminate form of mass arrest where you arrest everybody within a given geographical location. It's unconstitutional because under the Fifth Amendment, Fourth Amendment, you need to arrest somebody individualized, a probable cause based on individualized suspicion, and you don't have individualized suspicion for everybody within a certain radius. And the Office of Police Complaints, the official D.C. body, in its report on the inauguration said, oh, it's not our jurisdiction to make a determination about the probable cause of the arrest, but seems very likely it was lacking and that proximity was the basis, not probable cause for the arrest. So they sweep up these 234 people. This includes journalists, about 9 journalists, medics, legal observers, people who have done nothing wrong, and they hold them under very wretched conditions, apparently. And then they charge them with a single count of felony rioting. And then a few months later, they come back, and they bring 8 felony counts against 214 people, including a felony engaging in a riot, felony conspiracy to riot, felony inciting a riot, and all these property damage counts. So they are literally charging 214 people with breaking the same Starbucks window. And if I think anybody who is familiar with windows and people, it's pretty humanly impossible for 214 people to simultaneously break the same window, and the prosecution freely concedes that. So their theory of the case, and it's been called a conspiracy theory for good reason, is that the entire assembly is unlawful, and thus by participating in it, you've committed a crime. By going to this protest, you are guilty of the property damage, even if you never yourself threw a brick or did anything wrong. And if you look at the indictments they brought down, most of the defendants aren't actually named in the description of the event in the indictments. And most of the alleged criminal activity in the indictments aren't crimes. They're things like the people were wearing black clothes that were matching, or they were chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets." You know, and this is the evidence they're using of conspiracy, of rioting, of sort of a master plan here to I guess, cause trouble. And the people are facing 75 years in prison based on this legal theory. Since then, two of the felony charges for all of the protesters were reduced to misdemeanors. The reason being is that felony engaging in a riot is not a crime under the D.C. Statute. If you just had read the statute yourself, you would have noticed that. So the prosecutors charged them with a made-up offense. This is the second time this had happened. They had also brought a misdemeanor assaulting an officer charge against the protesters under a statute that no longer existed, had been repealed, so that one was dismissed as well. So it's not a particularly competent prosecution. But so for all of the protesters, they've had their 8 felony charges reduced to 6. They're facing 60 years instead of 75. And then there's a subgroup here, because they're trying them in different, they're not trying them all at once. They're trying them in different groups. There's a subgroup here of people who are going to trial on December the 13th, and they've had all of their charges reduced by the prosecutors to just 3 misdemeanors. There's just no explanation as to why that happened and what that means to the other defendants. But this week, right now, there are 7 defendants on trial. Jury selection started on Monday. They're facing the full 6 felony charges. They include Alexi Wood, who is a journalist, one of 2 journalists who are still facing felony charges, the other being Aaron Cantu, as well as a registered nurse who is acting as a medic. I mean, and the arresting of the protesters is outrageous, and we should condemn it. But the trying of the nurse and the journalist really proves the insidious and corrosive nature of the prosecution's legal theory here. I mean, the journalists were just doing their job. They were covering the protest and the types of things that the prosecutors alleged they did. They claimed that one journalist was wearing black. I guess, you know, never wear black is, I think, a takeaway here. And he was moving in proximity with the march. They also got some evidence from the right-wing group Project Veritas. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But so basically, by being a journalist and by being there, you know, you're guilty. So that's criminalizing journalism as well. With one of the journalists, Alexi Wood, he was a live streamer, so his own video shows very clearly he didn't engage in property damage. But at one point, I think something is damaged, and he lets out a whoa noise. And I think the prosecution is trying to argue that whoa was, you know, encouraging or inciting of the violence, as opposed to just sort of a natural reaction to an event occurring. So it's just an absolutely absurd prosecution. If it wasn't involving people going to jail for up to possibly 60 years, it would be laughable. But because it's so serious, it is a really, really disturbing and insidious prosecution.
Chip Gibbons, it sounds like on the day Donald Trump came into office in Washington, D.C., a whole brand new bunch of top officials of a police force arrived with just his level of competence and just his political ideology. I mean, who's behind this? What's the motivation? Why do this now, or rather, you know, better part of a year ago now, and not on other occasions? Who made this decision?
That's a really interesting question, and I've pondered that myself. So D.C., because it's not a state, it's sort of a almost colonial-like status within the U.S. federal system, they don't have state prosecutors. So the D.C. prosecutors work for the Department of Justice. So it is the Department of Justice bringing these charges. So technically they answer to Trump up the chain of command, but it's the local branch of the DOJ that does D.C. stuff. So it is, in fact, the Trump administration trying its own critics, but how much sway would Trump have or does have over this, I don't know. Another really interesting thing, though, is this happened, as I mentioned, I think, a number of times back during the World Bank days. People were kettled, they were arrested. And one of the worst instances of mass arrest, where the city got sued for millions of dollars, a police officer named Peter Newsman gave the arrest order. And he gave without warning or notice or anything like that, and he got sued over it. Peter Newsman was the acting police chief on January 20th, and he's now the Metropolitan Police Chief, in spite of the fact that he has a record of, you know, violating the rights of demonstrators. So that's a really interesting thing, that this guy did this in 2002, then he comes back and it's all of a sudden, you know, these same types of abuses are happening again. So I think there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle. I mean, there's also just an increasingly hostile environment for dissent in this country. We've seen a number of states try to pass anti-protest bills, doing everything from, you know, immunizing people who run over protesters with their cars to trying to impose criminal and civil liability on entire groups of protesters for the actions of a few. Arizona actually considered a bill that did not pass that would have allowed protest organizers to be tried under the RICO Act, you know, racketeering charges, what's supposed to be used against organized crime and the mob, for the actions of individuals at their protest who would commit acts of vandalism. So if you organize a protest, you announce it publicly on Facebook as you announce things, and a stranger shows up and then breaks the window, you're now facing the same types of charges as the mafia would face, although that was not passed. But I think the thing about that is the logic is so similar. It's about attempting to impose collective liability on people who protest. And the impact of that, of course, is going to be a chilling effect. If I think if I go to a protest and somebody I don't know throws a brick, I'm going to go to jail for 6 decades, I might just stay home. I might say the risk isn't worth it. I might decide to stay home that day. And you know, I think prosecutors know that. I think lawmakers know that. And I think that's what they want.
And this particular prosecution has gone beyond just these 200-some people in the sense that the prosecutors have sought information on anybody who signed up on a website about the protest or even liked the protest on a Facebook page and so forth. Isn't that part of the problem here?
One of the most fascinating things about this entire case, entire series of events, it's just one abuse has spawned other abuses. It's just been like an entirely out of control process. So you start with this illegal, unconstitutional mass arrest. Then you get this crazy legal theory about felony liability. And then in order to prove it, the Department of Justice is attempted to execute and did these warrants against DreamHost, which hosted the DisruptJ20.org website, as well as Facebook accounts for DisruptJ20 and three organizers who were never charged with a crime. And, I mean, the prosecution has sought to portray DisruptJ20.org as a website dedicated to organizing a premeditated riot. I don't know if you ever visited DisruptJ20.org or not. I suspect a lot of people did, obviously. They were trying to get 1.3 million IP addresses of people who did, so a lot did. But it was just a clearinghouse of information about all of the different protests that were happening that day.
But just people who visited it, not signed up for it or applauded it or gave money, just visited?
The original warrant from DOJ, they would have gotten the 1.3 million IP addresses of the visitors. After public outrage, they dropped that demand. I was actually at the hearing for the case. It was quite humorous in a dark way. The prosecutors claimed they never meant to ask for that data. They had no idea web providers had that data. And then the lawyer for DreamHost turned around and said, that's not true. In your warrant, you specifically ask for the IP address of visitors. And if you read the warrant, it says that. So
But that's like if you're a Fox News host and you went to that website in order to, you know, warn everybody against the evil dangers of the leftists, anarchists, and so forth, you would be on that list, right?
Yes, yes, you would, David. Yes, that is the insidious nature of it. Yeah, but they dropped that claim. There was still a lot of fighting about getting access to communications and listserv discussions. And the judge put some limits on what the prosecution could get. They had to redact the information of people. And then if looking at the message they had sent, they found evidence of crimes. Then they could get the judge to unredact it and probable cause. The prosecutor claimed during the hearing what they were looking for, or an example of what they were looking for, will be a listserv discussion about who was bringing the crowbars to the riot. And I think you and I both know that is an absurd statement. I mean, people don't have discussions like that on listservs. And since their entire trial is based on political speech, that's also not what they're looking for. They're looking for evidence of speech. With the Facebook hearing, which I also attended, the same prosecutor, they dropped the demand for the 6,000 likes of everyone who liked the page itself, but they claimed they needed a certain likes of criminal posts. And their argument was that a Facebook post like could be probative of criminal intent. For example, if you would like a post about how to, quote-unquote, dress in black block for the riot, that could be an example that you had the intent to riot that day. So it is really ridiculous. And another thing to point out is that they raided the homes of one of the organizers, and what the police seized as evidence, amongst other things, were copies of The Nation magazine and In These Times magazine.
Uh-huh.
So its entire case is a disaster for civil liberties, and it just keeps getting worse.
Maybe appropriate that The Nation just had an article warning against going after Russia TV as a, you know, as an evil foreign agent, since The Nation magazine is being picked up as evidence of nefarious intent itself.
Yeah, The Nation published my article on J20, and they did publish two really good articles on RT this week, both one by Katrina VandenHeuvel and Aaron Maté, and if you didn't read them, I highly recommend you do. Defending Rights in Defense has put out a statement condemning what DOJ did to RT as a threat to press freedom, but I'm not going to go off on that one. But yeah, you're right. They have done really good work on that issue when other left outlets would not.
What really disturbs me about this J20 prosecution and a lot of what's happening in our culture is the blurring of any line between criminal activity and activism. Activism as protected by the First Amendment, activism as, you know, a traditional legal, if not, you know, praiseworthy and necessary activity. And I saw Jeff Sessions testifying in Congress this week, you know, being asked about, you know, doing reports on black identity extremists. And he's just referring to, you know, extremist activists, as if, you know, an activist is something bad. Am I right that this is a new trend being driven by these sorts of prosecutions?
I think in some ways you are correct. I mean, Defending Rights in Defense traces its founding back to a group that was opposed to the House Un-American Activities Committee that was founded in 1960. So we've had several decades of taking on sort of the criminalization of activism. So I don't think it's an entirely new trend. I do think it ebbs and flows. I think it ebbs and flows based on the strength of social movements. And I think right now we're seeing a real escalation of it. And I think that's because you're seeing so many successful social movements around issues like Black Lives Matter, around Standing Rock, around Palestinian human rights. And as a result, you know, the hammer of the state's coming down now. The blurring of the lines between activism and criminality, I think, is a really disturbing point because, in theory, my First Amendment right is individually held. So if you and I, David, go to a protest and you do something rowdy and illegal, you throw a brick, I don't then lose my right to protest just because you did that. I mean, you get arrested in theory, you lost your right, but my right is still individually held. And what this case is arguing is that the protest itself is part of the conspiracy, and just by being there, I'm guilty. So there's two defendants who showed up late, and their attorneys tried to have their charges dismissed, being like, they couldn't possibly know what was going on. They came late, and the prosecutor's like, no, they were trying to find the black block. That's evidence of, you know, conspiracy. And it's just so insidious and ridiculous. And when you look at the quote-unquote evidence in the indictment, it's they were chanting, whose streets are streets? They were marching together in proximity, and you know, they're using these acts of clearly First Amendment protected expression to try to hold people liable for, you know, basically breaking a Starbucks window. And while breaking a Starbucks window is, you know, technically is illegal, I mean, it shouldn't carry 60 to 75 years in prison. I mean, even in that situation, the charges are completely and utterly absurd. The prosecution alleges that the protesters did $100,000 in damage. The D.C. City Council has spent up now $150,000 investigating police misconduct during that same incident. So maybe the police should be on trial.
I wouldn't be opposed. But a trial, you said, of seven individuals out of 214 has started, is underway. Do you know what's happened there?
214 people were originally charged. There were plea deals and stuff like that. So it's down to 194 people are still facing charges. The first trial of the first seven people, who I believe are people who demanded their right to a speedy trial, began on November the 15th. Opening arguments haven't happened yet. It's still in jury selection. I believe opening arguments were supposed to start on Monday of next week, but it seems like they might be delayed until after the Thanksgiving holiday. I've heard murmurings of that. So we're still in the jury selection phase. I plan on going to opening arguments because, if anything, just to hear how the prosecutor attempts to explain their ridiculous behavior. But, I mean, watching these first seven cases is going to be really important, because if we get a bunch of acquittals, you know, what's the prosecutor going to do next? It seems like they would then have pressure to drop the rest of the charges because they know it's not going to go anywhere. Will they do that or not? I don't know. If the jury, on the other hand, returns guilty verdicts, which I don't see how they could based on the evidence, but I don't see how the grand jury could have returned an indictment based on the evidence, which is another interesting issue. If you allow me one brief aside, one of the motions the defense filed was to disclose the instructions the prosecution gave on the law to the grand jury, not the whole grand jury hearings because those are secret, but just what the legal instructions were, because, you know, they charged them under a non-existent statute, and the defendant's attorneys argued that, you know, no reasonable jury could bring back an indictment based on this evidence of they were just chanting and stuff like that. You know, what was the legal instructions? The judge denied that. But so if the jury comes back with guilty verdicts, though, that's going to bode potentially really bad for the rest of the trials, and the prosecution will not have an incentive to drop the cases.
And this is a D.C. jury we're talking about, right?
The D.C. jury, yes.
Chip Gibbons, we have just a few minutes left. I know that RootsAction.org, where I work, has signed on to a letter. What's, among other things, what's happening with that, and what else can people do to get involved if they're concerned about this and want to have an impact?
Sure. So the letter that Roots Action signed on to was a letter initiated by Defending Rights in Dissent to the U.S. Attorney for D.C. It's specifically calling for the charges against Aaron Cantu and Alexi Wood to be dropped. It's about the specific concerns with press freedom and how bringing felony charges against journalism, a journalist for covering protest, endangers press freedom. And it was signed on by Roots Action, DRAD, and a number of press freedom groups like PEN America, Freedom of the Press Foundation, Free Press, The Nation Institute. So that letter is specifically focused on the two journalists and defending press freedom. In addition to that, Defending Rights in Dissent is doing a petition drive to the same prosecutor to get all of the charges dropped. Demand Progress and Free Press are participating in it. Some other groups might as well. And we plan on dropping those charges off sometime, and not charges off, dropping those petitions off to drop the charges sometime in the near future. So if you want to sign one of those, go to rightsanddissent.com and do so. And I would say just stay vigilant and just watch the proceedings as they go along. And you can also donate to DC Legal Posse or any of the legal defense funds, because many of the defendants are from, you know, out of town, and it's hard for them to get here, and legal costs are expensive.
Yeah. Actually, I have about 2 minutes left. Another aspect of what I see as a trend here, although obviously not brand new in world history, is that these police are increasingly dressed like they're in the military and talking like they're in the military and trained by U.S. military and Israeli military and so forth. How does that relate to this habit of not treating people as individuals, but treating them as a group? Because a military doesn't, you know, blow up individuals.
That's a really valid point. I mean, a local law enforcement, in theory, they purport, they're there to protect and serve the community. Whether or not that's what they do or whether or not that's what they really are aiming to do is a different story. But in theory, that's what they're doing. You know, militaries invade and occupy and fight wars. So if they're embracing this military aspect, then they're fighting a war. They're waging a war against the community they're supposed to be protecting. And that, you know, that would, you know, contribute to the, you know, get everyone type mentality.
And presumably that could have something to do with the fact that they're not distinguishing individuals as criminals any more than the U.S. military is, you know, distinguishing individuals as criminals in foreign countries rather than blowing up neighborhoods.
Yeah, no, I think you've raised a really salient point.
It's an incredible story. I'm glad you're staying on top of it and writing about it. I'm glad The Nation is publishing about it. Chip Gibbons' article in The Nation is called "The Prosecution of Inauguration Day Protesters is a Threat to Dissent." We'll have a link to it up at talknationradio.org. Chip Gibbons is the Policy and Legislative Counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as an active journalist. Chip Gibbons, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Always a pleasure to be on Talk Nation Radio.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as Americans celebrate a fairy tale about the relationship between Native Americans and settlers, Native Americans are mourning the pollution of more of their land and lives by fossil fuels. The November 16th spill of more than 200,000 gallons of oil from the Keystone Pipeline occurred adjacent to the South Dakota reservation of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Oyadeh tribe. The inevitability of such spills is, of course, only one of many reasons millions of people resist pipelines like Keystone. Last August, Counterspin heard from Candy Mossett, Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She talked about the peaceful protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. We're going to revisit that conversation today. Climate disruption is many stories, not just big messes like oil spills, but some, maybe subtler but no less meaningful impacts, like birds disappearing from your backyard. We talked about some of the less discussed changes with environmental writer Dan Zukowski. We'll hear some of that, too. There's no scientific controversy. We have to keep fossil fuels in the ground. The fight is entirely political. Inside Climate News reporter Marianne Lavelle spoke with us early in the Trump administration about how the White House's plans are setting us back. And finally, why in 2017 do corporate media insist on making ideological room for climate change denialists and go-slowers, even as working journalists report the utterly undeniable? We spoke with Fair's own editor Jim Narikas about that. Climate disruption and corporate media's compromised and inadequate response this week on Counterspin. Counterspin's brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When we spoke with Candy Mossett in August of 2016, the Standing Rock Sioux had been engaged in peaceful protest over the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline for months. Drawing solidarity from Indigenous people and others around the country and the world, and repression from state authorities. Big media took little notice. None of the three major TV networks had said word one, with social, independent, and especially Native media doing the work of getting the story out. Candy Mossett is Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. We asked her to explain what the struggle was about.
I think it's important to understand where we are here in North Dakota. It has a history of being a fossil fuel state. I grew up here in North Dakota. I was born, raised here. My family majority lives here. And I sort of had to work my way through how we were different or set apart from other areas. We had a lot of people in this state that had a lot of sicknesses and illnesses, particularly in my family, particularly on my reservation, which is just northwest of here, known today by the government as the Fort Berthold Reservation, but known by us as the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nations. We're surrounded by 7 coal-fired power plants, and the country's only coal gasification plant. Every single bit of the over 11,000 miles of rivers, lakes, and streams that are in North Dakota are already contaminated with mercury contamination because of the coal industry here. So that history already exists. And then we have fracking, which started in 2007, 2008, and we started seeing so much development taking place. And that's how, you know, we learned about the Dakota Access Pipeline, and they wanted to come through North Dakota and start here. And we had just been fresh, myself working with the Indigenous Environmental Network, just fresh off of fighting against the Keystone XL pipeline, which many people are calling this Keystone XL Part 2, because it's still another way to move and transport oil, although now it's Bakken oil, which is being dug out directly under my feet at my homelands, and I'm seeing the devastation. So I think the media has always had a blackout from the bad things around energy development and around oil industry or gas or coal or anything to do with fossil fuels, because they feel like it's a good thing for our state because it provides jobs is what the main headline is. What they don't tell people is that North Dakota does have a low unemployment rate. Yes, we always have. You can look back to statistics before even this Bakken oil boom, and we've had a 3% or 4% unemployment rate in our state, which is the same today. And so it's politicians here protecting the work that they know. I think that they don't know any better. It's business as usual. And because this infrastructure is already set up for fossil fuel development, they don't want the rest of the country to know and understand the struggles and the suffering that those of us on the ground have faced on a day-to-day basis. I'm getting emotional because I am a cancer survivor. And there are so many around me that are fighting and struggling with it now, and I truly believe that the health of our people is impacted directly by the fossil fuel development. And it's frustrating that the media is not telling the truth about what's happening here. The truth being, we are peaceful protectors of water and of health. And we want our future generations to not have to deal with the cancers and the asthmas and the problems we've been facing here in this state. And also to let the rest of the country know that what happens in North Dakota does not stay here. The water, the Missouri River, flows downstream all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, you know, all the way down through to the oceans. And the toxins, the pollutions, the dioxins, the carcinogenic poisons, the cancer-causing poisons that are being put in our water flow downstream. And this air that we breathe blows through the rest of the world, and we do not want that to be our legacy as concerned community members and people that live here.
Well, the Sacred Stones camp seems focused very much on a response to that broader and ongoing historical environmental context, but on an interruption of that business as usual, on saying we want to say no and call attention to our saying no to this. And I think that's why it's so galvanizing and exciting for people. And I wonder if you could tell us, this is, as you say, a peaceful protest, a prayer protest, and it was begun, wasn't it, by women. Women have a central role here.
Women do have a central role. That's not to say that men don't have a role as well. There was ceremony that were led by four leaders that were actually men that went into ceremony, but through the support of the women. The actual blockade itself, some of the things that people may have seen were when the field was stormed by a group of women. It started with one woman that went out and took the field on the West Bank where they were trying to build a road to bring in the heavy equipment which would help pull the pipe under the water for boring. So when they bore, they go underneath the ground instead of trenching and laying a pipe directly on top of the water, on like on the waterbed. So that's how the industry and how our state officials that signed off on this project make themselves feel better, is that they say they're being environmentally responsible by boring, but they still have to build all these roads. They still have to bring in all this equipment, and that pipe can still leak. The problem is that it'll be 90 feet below ground, so you won't detect the leak as immediately. So it's really kind of interesting in that regard, but women stormed the field and went out. The workers didn't know what to do. They just stopped their equipment. They were like, okay, hold on, and shut down and walked away, and they were like, okay, go ahead, jump up there. And that effectively is what stop the work, because there hasn't been this level of pushback in North Dakota, I don't think, ever before. I mean, our tribes, the Menda and Hidatsa, Rikara Nations, and certainly the Standing Rock Sioux fought back against the building of the dams that created our reservoirs here. Lake Sakakawea and Lake Oahe are reservoirs that are man-made that were created by a dam, and that was in the 50s, late 40s. We fought back then, but not to this extent where so many people came and stood with us, because we lost that battle. And now here we are trying to protect what was we were forced into having a reservoir to get our water supplies from. And now they're threatening those reservoirs with this pipeline.
Right. Well, I hear a quiet voice in the background there.
I do have my 3-year-old here with me at the camp, and I have to say something that if I thought it was a violent place, I wouldn't have her with me. And there are also other children out here as well.
That's an excellent point, because a lot of what coverage I have seen has focused on conflict, has focused on violence. And to the extent that they talk about the concerns get a phrase, which is the indigenous people or the Standing Rock are concerned that a leak in the pipeline will pollute their drinking water. Well, I would say, first of all, leaks are not fears, really. I mean, look at history. They are near certainty, you know, pipeline leaks. But also, it's important to say that it is not just the fear of a leak that is the concern here. There are other concerns as well, aren't there?
There are many, many, many concerns. And they have to do with spirituality, too. I mean, that's why we come here in prayer. everything is impacted, not just what a person might see on the surface. It's not just the water, and it's not just us as human beings. It's everything that relies on that water, the four-legged, the winged, everything that swims in those waters is impacted, yet doesn't have a voice to say, no, protect us, we don't want this either. It's all of the processes that go into getting that pipe there in the first place. And then that pipe isn't just here, it's through several states, in fact. In the big picture, the long term, what that's doing is it's saying that it's okay to continue business as usual when we know that our planet is in climate chaos because of anthropogenic causes, human-induced causes of messing with our Earth systems and our Earth cycles. We burn these oils and these fossil fuels and we put them into the atmosphere, never knowing the full impact of what it's going to do. Well, I should correct myself. We didn't know before, maybe at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but we certainly know now. We know that ethane and methane are causing warming temperatures, which are causing people to be displaced in the island states, in the Philippines. People are being displaced right now. We have all of these storms that are occurring, these hurricanes and flooding in Louisiana, where my friend Cherie Foytlin down there is fighting to say another Gulf is possible, yet she's cleaning the walls out of her home, cutting the walls out so they don't get mold because they were flooded. There's fires in California that are burning everything. There's intense heat in the Northeast. These are related. All of this is not a coincidence, and it's kind of taking a step back and looking at the big picture and seeing that this is not just a fight about this one pipeline. This is a fight to protect our planet for all of us as humanity.
The same corporate media who presented Standing Rock as a story of violent protesters interfering with the lawful workings of industry talk about climate disruption itself as an abstraction, represented often by the image of a polar bear stranded on an ice floe. Getting reporters to pay attention to all of the stories of climate change is an urgent effort. Counterspin spoke with environmental writer Dan Zukowski about recent work he'd done for Enviro News about, for one thing, songbirds.
They looked at 48 species of songbirds, and these are birds that migrate primarily from Central and South America up to places in North America, in the U.S. and Canada, for their summer migration. Because of the changes in climate patterns, and those changes are somewhat different in different parts of North America, it's kind of throwing these birds off as to when they should leave their winter homes in Central and South America and when they should arrive here in their summer homes in North America. They found, for example, that in Vermont, winter has been shortening by 4 days per decade for the last several decades. So the trees are blooming and the grass is coming out, and maybe the birds aren't even here yet. So it's an issue if these birds arrive too early, it will be cold and they may not be able to find a place to nest. They may not find a mate because their mate hasn't arrived yet. On the other hand, if they arrive too late, it's the opposite. All the best nesting places may be taken. So there's a real impact. And it's kind of funny because one of the researchers there in that article said you would think that birds who know how to migrate over thousands of miles would be easiest to adapt.
Right.
But they have hundreds of thousands of generations of cues, such as the length of daylight, that haven't changed. And they use those things to determine when to leave and when to arrive. And when they get to their summer homes, things are not what they expect. These birds may adapt over years and generations going forward as the, for example, the earlier birds will survive better than the birds who arrive later. But that's sort of the workings of evolution that happen much more slowly.
Right. Well, the work on birds is just a piece of this article because it's about various species' response to climate destabilization. And folks might think it's interesting that it includes trees, but trees are moving, if you will, too. And that also has implications.
Yeah, trees are moving. Of course, it's not an individual tree that gets up and walks, but it's where certain concentrations of trees they call the center of abundance for a particular tree species, whether it be oaks or certain forms of conifers and so forth. What they're finding is that trees are basically moving north and west. They're moving a bit more in the study that was done to the west, about 50 feet per decade west and about 36 feet per decade north. And these, again, are due to both precipitation changes and temperature changes. Other researchers have also seen trees moving further up mountains. This has been seen in Colorado and California and other places where, as the global temperatures warm, tree species that couldn't survive previously at higher elevations now can. The implications of this is that it changes the entire ecosystem and it changes the food supply for the animals, whether it be birds or other terrestrial animals, that depend on this vegetation to survive.
Right.
It's funny that you start off with the polar bear issue. Well, the polar bears, of course, have no place further to go. There is no more north for them. But another piece I'm working on now is looking at how grizzly bears are now being seen in polar bear habitat, where they've either never been seen before or have only been seen very rarely. I've been to the Canadian tundra. It's a very inhospitable place. There's not a lot growing there. And polar bears don't care because they're not eating vegetation. They're just waiting to get out and hunt for seals. But grizzly bears, as the vegetation changes and it becomes more something that they can actually eat, well, it's going to draw them further north. So we're seeing some conflicts. We're even seeing some interbreeding among grizzly bears and polar bears. When you change one thing in the ecosystem, lots of things ripple out.
Listeners will know questions about climate change played virtually no role in coverage of the presidential election, but there was no surprise when Donald Trump, who once referred to it as a Chinese hoax, filled his administration with extractive industry types invested in denial. Marianne Lavelle is a veteran environmental journalist, now a reporter for Inside Climate News. We asked her about the impact of the new White House on, for instance, the U.S.'s commitments under the Paris Agreement.
President Obama had made a very ambitious pledge, but felt that it was an achievable pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions about 26 to 28% by 2025. And that was based on levels from 2005. Well, we've cut emissions, you know, about a third since then. So the Obama plan was really to achieve the rest through this whole array of different regulations and possibilities. And very key to that was the Clean Power Plan to attack those emissions from power plants, which are our biggest single source of emissions.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is number one target for elimination by President Trump. Of course, the EPA is the agency that's supposed to be executing all of these rules, or most of them. There was a regulation on methane, and the Obama administration felt that this would be a very achievable goal of cutting methane emissions from the oil and gas industry, because methane, although a very, very potent greenhouse gas, we have the technology to capture any methane leaks. We just need to monitor and detect and make sure that it's not leaking. But the oil industry has been very opposed to having federal rules on that. And one of the first things that the new EPA did was put a stop to most of the regulation for methane from oil and gas. Regulations on energy efficiency, on car efficiency, all of those seem to be in the sights of the White House. And this was the ladder we were going to use to reach our target for the Paris Agreement.
Clearly, as you've touched on, cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency itself are going to be harmful. And I would note that in one piece you wrote, you showed how small a slice of the budget EPA actually accounts for.
Yes, you almost need a magnifying glass to see it. If you look at the whole federal budget, it's 0.2% of 1% of that budget. They certainly aren't going to get a lot of money by cutting all of these programs. And that shows that it's not about money. It's an ideological, and also they're looking at what businesses are going to be favored under this administration. And although the EPA is a very small agency, the oil, gas, and coal industries are very much affected by what it does, and they have been fighting it for quite some time. And now they feel they're going to be successful in really reducing the agency's clout.
Well, you mentioned ideology, and I think Scott Pruitt's history, of course, is telling. I understood that he just tweeted last month that he was dedicated to working with, quote, stakeholders, industry, farmers, ranchers, business owners, on traditional values of environmental stewardship, close quote. Are those all the stakeholders? Somebody's missing there.
The public doesn't get really mentioned in that, which, of course, is the biggest stakeholder that the EPA was actually established to protect. But this is Scott Pruitt. This was his view even when he was Attorney General in Oklahoma. Talk about the whole idea of corporations as persons. That was part of the public that he was serving, and some would say a large part of what he did when he was suing the EPA 14 times as Attorney General was serving the Oklahoma oil and gas industry. So that is really where we stand.
Some 200,000 people gathered in Washington, D.C. in late April this year for the People's Climate March, identified as being about climate, jobs, and justice. But just as so many see the urgent need to marshal forces to meet an unprecedented crisis and heal its already evident harms, corporate media, some of whom have vigorously branded themselves as bastions of rationality in a post-truth world, continue to boggle us with backward-looking decisions, like that of the New York Times to give a regular column to former Wall Street Journal deputy editorial page editor Brett Stevens. Jim Narikas is editor of FAIR's newsletter Extra and FAIR.org. He joined the show to talk about the sad kind of sense such a choice actually makes.
Brett Stevens does have a record at the Wall Street Journal, and you can see what kind of writer he is. He's the kind of writer who publishes articles like Global Warming as Mass Neurosis and Palestine, the Psychotic Stage. He's published defenses of torture. You know, this is the kind of writer he is. And the New York Times is insisting that we need to broaden the range of debate so we can have climate denial and anti-Arab racism and torture advocacy as part of our news diet. And I really want to ask, like, why? Why do we want to have someone denying that the greatest calamity facing the planet, that it is happening? Why do we want to have people who talk about the disease of the Arab mind as their explanation for Mideast conflict? Why is this helping the discussion? What are we adding to our intellectual diet by reading these views on the pages of the New York Times op-ed page?
You're talking about racism and pro-torture advocacy, and for a lot of people, that has actually been off the page, and all the focus has been about climate, you know, and so it's interesting that his very first piece was about climate and the one fact that it had, they had to add a correction to it. But the direction you're taking it, I mean, the fact that they had to correct the one fact in his first column kind of tells you really that it's not about facts for them, you know, that the facts are kind of secondary. And, you know, Susan Matthews at Slate had a piece about how his piece wasn't really about facts. It was really kind of classic denialism in saying, aren't we all uncertain? Isn't everything uncertain? You know, people thought Hillary Clinton would win the election and they were wrong, and that's much more insidious, you know, and it's much more Timesian. You know, classy people find nuance in everything.
You can tell by reading that column, he does not know anything about the climate. He does not care anything about the climate. What he cares about is antagonizing liberals. And he did this very effectively at the Wall Street Journal and got applause from his readers there. Now his role is slightly different. And he was like mocking the idea of global warming when he was at the Wall Street Journal and saying that people who believed in global warming were members of a cult, and confidently predicted that in 100 years, temperatures would be the same as they are now. Now he's at the New York Times, and he is, I'm very thoughtful, and I'm thinking that we're too certain about things, and we should be less certain.
Right.
And he throws out this fact as an example of the kind of thing that we all agree on about climate, and it garbles it completely. It's one fact in the column, and he flubs it. He describes the global temperature rise as the Northern Hemisphere temperature rise. And now he claims, there is some contribution that humans are giving to global temperature rise, but we really can't say for sure how much or what we should do about it. Or the effect is the same. Let's not do anything.
Right.
But now he's got a more Timesian approach to it.
I find it so galling because part of what he's saying and part of what defenders from the Times editorial page are saying on Twitter and elsewhere is, people who are critical of Stevens don't want to have a conversation, you know. Now, of course, it's galling on the first level of, no, we don't want to have a conversation about slavery either. We think some things are done and we want to move on. And here, too, there's so much conversation to be had about how the world would respond to climate change. There's so much to talk about.
Yes, yeah.
We have to retrofit an economy. We have to, there's a whole lot to talk about. It's not that people don't want to have a conversation.
The actual debate in science that's going on about global warming is how bad the effects will be. There are reasons to think that there are multiplier effects in the climate that will make the temperature rise much worse. You know, and the effects that humanity will have to endure are much greater. That is the actual debate that serious people are having about the serious disaster that is affecting the world. And the New York Times would rather be able to say, well, we have the people who say global warming is quite serious and we should do something about it someday. And we also have the people who say it's not so serious and we don't need to do anything about it right now. And that's the debate that they want to have, because that is the debate that you can have at your cocktail party, and everyone will feel pretty comfortable about that debate.
That was Fair's Jim Narikis. Before that, you heard Marianne Lavelle, Dan Zukowski, and Candy Mossett. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group Fair, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In all our lives in the so-called information society, we do not know how our bodies react to heat. And planet Earth is erupting in heat waves, with tens of thousands dead at a time, with more to come, many more, as warming rules. In this program, you will learn how heat kills and your own risk. We'll also hear a warning from 15,000 scientists. That crested the serious newspapers for a few seconds, but it is a second warning to humanity. We'll hear from the man who started it. It all wraps up with a short chat with a young futurist about sponge cities. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Good luck. If you have a body and believe more heat waves will come, you need to hear this interview. We're going to explore new science with a title that is starkly clear: 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. In April 2017, I interviewed Dr. Camilo Mora. He led a team of 14 scientists from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. They concluded that somewhere between 2033 and 2070, nothing will be the same in a hotter world. That is when the Earth will get a whole new climate. Humans are already dying, as you know, by the thousands, even by the tens of thousands, in deadly heat waves. We don't know when that may become millions of deaths. In fact, until a work just published by Camilo Mora's team, Nobody had studied all the ways our bodies react to excess heat. Camilo Mora is from the Department of Geography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, where he heads the Mora Lab. From Honolulu, Dr. Mora, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. A pleasure to be with you again.
Is your new paper a logical question arising from your earlier work on the arrival of a new hot climate?
Yes, and in fact, we even after we published the paper that you're talking about, we did a second paper looking at heat waves that had killed people in the past. And what we decided was to investigate how many of them had happened, and we found close to 2,000 cases since 1980 when the conditions got to be too hot and people died. Some of these cases, as you point out, killed up to 70,000 people in a couple of weeks, like the one in Europe in 2003, that heat wave. It's amazing that killed 70,000 people. There was another heat wave in Russia in 2010, and that killed 15,000 people. There was a heat wave in Pakistan and India in the last 2 years that killed 4,000 to 5,000 people. So, and we found on that one paper about close to 2,000 cases, just like that, of people dying around the world because it got to be too hot. Now, after we published that paper, one of the things that was very intriguing to me was the fact that on all of those papers and all of those cases that we review, it was very vague how people died during those heat waves. So everybody knew people died on those days, but why they died? And the reason why that became important to me is because most people is getting the impression that it's only the poor people, the elderly people, the one that had no money to buy air conditioning, the people that are dying during this heat wave. So we decided to investigate how is it that people is dying, and we ended up reviewing the medical literature. We review a lot of papers about how medically is that you die, and we found that when you put all of those pathways together, there are 27 ways in which you can die during a heat wave, and they can pretty much happen to anybody. So for me, it was just mind-blowing to find that there are so many of them, you know. I just expected to be maybe one or two ways in which you die during these heat waves, but finding out that there were 27 ways, it was just mind-blowing to me, because that just points out the fact that as a human, we are very delicate to heat, and unfortunately, the planet is getting hotter. So you get the combination of two terrible things coming our way.
Well, it is amazing. I mean, we learn a little bit about our basic organs and maybe circulation in school, and then we don't really know how heat is dangerous for us. And what you've just said stimulates another memory in me. In 2008, I broadcast a recorded briefing for congressional staffers about how smog kills. And it was Dr. Joel Schwartz, I think. He was Harvard's top pollution expert. And he said that we don't know how many deaths are caused by smog because the death certificates, they never say that. It's often listed as heart failure or something else. Do you think there's a similar lack of statistics and maybe underestimation of the number of heat deaths?
Oh, big time, big time. I mean, even on the developed world, there is not a sad diagnosis for when you die from a heat wave. Normally, obviously, at the end of the day, when you die from this thing, your heart stops, and most likely the diagnosis is that you had a heart attack. But it turns out that there were all kind of changes happening to your body and damages happening to your body that ultimately make the heart to stop. So obviously, all of that gets clustered within heart attack, and obviously there is a huge underdiagnosis of the number of people dying during these heat waves because there is just no such a thing as a good diagnosis when people die from heat wave. Now, that's one of the things for the developed world. The things are obviously worse for the developing world. What we found on the paper in April about the heat waves that are killing people is that we found that all of these heat waves that are killing people are happening at mid latitudes, mostly developed countries like the United States, Australia, Japan, Canada, Europe, all developed countries. So for me, that was very intriguing. Is either this heat wave just killing the rich? Now, what we did find was that the climatic conditions that have killed people in those countries, those same climatic conditions are also happening on poor countries. So what that suggests to me was that in developing countries, these heat waves are also killing people. It's just that they don't have the resources to have the good research to find out how many of them are. So, yes, going back to your question where this is being underestimated, I'm confident that this is being underestimated not only on the developed world, but much bigger in the developing world.
Well, let's dig into the very good science in your paper about how our bodies really work when they get overheated. And I'd like to go step by step, Camilo, as you do in your very helpful press release about the paper. I've read the full paper, but that press release really helped me get oriented. And the first process we all experience is that blood flows towards the skin trying to cool us off. But what really happens there that is a risk?
So the risk that comes from when you get overheated, just like when you go for a run and you start overheating, your body starts generating heat and you need to expel the heat. So the body, what it does there is start making the heart pump harder, and it closes blood flow to many organs in a way so that all of the blood now goes to your skin, where it gets cooled down through the process of evaporation of your sweat. So the blood cools down and then it comes back in into your body cooler. Now, the problem when it's hot outside is that the sweat doesn't evaporate, then the blood comes back in hot. So the body makes an extra effort then to send even more blood to your skin for it to cool down. By doing so, what it happens is that it deprives many organs of blood. And that's what is called ischemia. Basically, several organs start being deprived of blood. And what it does is that it creates these anoxic conditions on those organs, right? And when you have a lack of oxygen on those organs, then that creates all kind of chemical reactions there that are detrimental to that organ. The organ that is the most critical, interestingly enough, I found, was the gut. Obviously, you are hot, you just want to cool down the body. The first organ that it cuts the blood supply to are the gut, because you don't need the gut when it's pretty hot. But unfortunately, if the conditions are very long, the gut, the lining of your intestines breaks, and now all of the things that you had inside your guts leak in into your bloodstream. And what you ended up having is this massive contamination of your body with everything that was in your guts into your bloodstream. And again, all of that, the result of the fact that there was just no blood getting into your guts. And that's one of the mechanisms that we found causes people to die during these heat waves. Basically, your guts just break, and that obviously is a cause for death.
But I had no idea that was happening. So how did you find that out?
Well, it turns out that there are many disciplines that have investigated that quite a lot. Like, for instance, people that do a lot of exercises outdoors, like sport people, military people, mining. These are jobs in which a lot of people have died because of excess heat. So the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot on those cases. And that's how the medical literature is very rich on how people die from heat, because in certain jobs, the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot. Unfortunately, when it comes to heat waves, we just lack the research to study that. But thankfully, we already know that well from other disciplines.
And what is heat cytotoxicity? Did you already cover that?
No. So another thing that happens, obviously the ischemia is one that can kill you. The other one that can kill you as well is what is called heat cytotoxicity. So when the blood comes back in hot, and obviously your body is generating more heat, the temperature of the body gets higher than the optimum temperature, which is roughly 37 degrees Celsius. So if it gets hotter than that, then basically you start cooking yourself. Think about like a sunburn. So many organs start getting damaged, physically damaged, but some other organs can also break. Yeah, but just imagine this like a massive sunburn, and eventually your skin just peels off. So the same thing happens, but now inside your body, and what it does, of course, is that it starts helping the breaking of the membranes that maintain the structure of many of these organs. So the heart, for instance, start breaking into pieces, and then it doesn't work as good in a moment when you need your heart very bad. So having a sex heat is pretty bad for your heart. It's also terrible for your lungs. Obviously, you start respirating more because you need more oxygen. And with this heat cytotoxicity and you cooking your lungs, the lungs don't work as well. So many people start also suffering from lack of oxygen getting to their bloodstream. And that is what is called heat cytotoxicity, basically the time when the temperature is hotter than what the temperature that can be tolerated by yourself.
Does the immune system get involved?
We didn't find literature on that. We know that there is something called a shock thermal proteins, which is, again, just one response for the body to keep up with that heat. But our reading of that was that those are processes that normally take time to develop. But as for the immune system itself, we just didn't come across any specific paper talking about it, but that's not to say that they are not.
And then there's blood clots. Really, blood clots are a factor in heating?
Oh, big time. So what happens is when you break the lining of your guts, now the human body realizes that you are getting contaminated. So you have something that is called white blood cells, and they start attacking those contamination bacteria and food that now you have going through your bloodstream. And the way to kill it is just by creating coagulation around it, right? And now what you ended up having is a potential solution for healing the body, turning into a something that can kill you. So that's one mechanism. The other mechanism is that you have these clogging proteins that, interestingly enough, are sensitive to heat, so they become overreactive. So everywhere they are, they just create coagulation wherever they are. Now, so that the clogging can kill you, right, because you ended up getting a clog, but the other problem that will happen is the fact that you will start running out of the clogging protein, so that if you had a smart cut, you can bleed to death because the body cannot clog it, because you pretty much use all of your resources of those proteins. So those cloggings are actually bad from both ends. They can kill you because they clog the blood, and when you run out of them, the lack of proteins that clog can also kill you, because you can have a danger of dying from an hemorrhage just because there is no clogging proteins left.
But I assume a process like that doesn't happen quickly. I mean, we're talking about a longer exposure to heat before all those systems could interact and kick in?
So that happens, it varies quite a lot, we presume, because there is not really research into this by individual. So there are certain individuals, for instance, the elderly, the isolated, people that is exposed to heat constantly, in which their temperature rises pretty fast, and unfortunately their body doesn't have the capacity to cope with it, so basically cooling down. So imagine of it like running a marathon. Yeah, so you can go and you can select 1,000 people to run a marathon, and most likely 10 of them will finish it. Most of us are just going to finish up. We are probably never going to finish it up. So the same thing goes during this heat wave. So you start stressing the body, and not everybody is going to be able to sustain it. And the extent to which these mechanisms start kicking in depends on how strong really you are at that moment. And, of course, many people is going to get filtered early on, and some of us might endure it at the end. So the answer to your question is that depends obviously on how good the body is at the moment when they get exposed to that heat.
But if we go to a sports game, we expect those teams to play even though it's really, really hot. Although we had a couple of tennis players fall over in Australia, I think it was a couple of years ago, in heat there. Should we be closing games down if it's that hot, or should we even be exercising ourselves?
No. They do that normally. Obviously, doing exercise is not a bad thing, because what happens when you do exercise on a normal day is that the body can sweat and you feel the cooling. In fact, if you are doing massive exercise and you stop for a moment, you start feeling that the sweat starts evaporating, right? That's because the humidity is low and that evaporation cools you down. The problem is when you do that when it's hot, because basically there is no mechanism for the body to cool down. And that's when the thing becomes dangerous. And here in the United States, I have seen multiple times where referees had to stop the game for people to just go and get drink water and cool down a little bit, because it becomes potentially dangerous if you continue to be exposed to that extreme heat while doing exercise.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest from the University of Hawaii is Dr. Camilo Mora. He's the lead author of 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. Well, we're just getting started with this heating. We can stay inside with air conditioning, we think, as long as the power's on. But what about the 600 million people in India, for example, who do not have electricity at all? What are their prospects as global warming develops?
Well, first of all, I don't think the air conditioning is really a solution to this problem, yeah? Because imagine, let me just give you an analogy. I am a good friend with Mike Tyson, and Mike Tyson every time keep punching me on the face, right? So we're good friends, but every time he just keep punching me on the face. Now, my solution to that problem is to use protective gear on my face so I don't get, when he punched me, I don't feel the pain. Right, so the same analogy goes here with the air conditioning. We had a heat wave that is killing people, and our solution to it is just to buy air conditioning so we don't feel the pain. Personally, I would prefer the solution for it to be not to be heat waves at all. Just like in the case of my friend Mike Tyson, I would like him not to punch me at all. Yeah. So this idea that we are going to escape these dangers of this heat by buying air conditioning is fair game, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the best solution, because at the end of the day, these heat waves are still going to be just as lethal outside. Now, but you point out a very interesting point, though, which is the fact that many millions, if not billions, of people around the world just don't have the resources and money to buy an air conditioning, much less to pay for the electricity that it will cost. Now, that's for the developing world. Now, for the developed world, the problem is going to be the electrical grids, because during those heat waves, the electrical wires cannot conduct electricity as good because it's pretty hot. To make matters worse, everybody's turning on their air conditioning. So it has been found in multiple cases in the developed world when these heat waves are happening and everybody turn on their air conditioning that the whole electrical grid collapses. Yeah, and obviously that becomes a potential death sentence for many people because you're in the middle of a heat wave and you cannot turn on your air conditioning. And again, that's another argument that I use to suggest that really what we need to do is to prevent these heat waves from happening in the first place.
I'll bet most Americans have forgotten about the Chicago heat wave of 1995. Over 700 people died in 5 days. They parked refrigerator trucks outside the overflowing morgues to hold them. And one factor in Chicago was fear of crime. Seniors died inside their rooms because they were afraid to leave a window open. So I guess social factors can be important in all this, too.
Yes, I mean, that's another big issue for the good and for the bad. Right now, for instance, in the United States, this past summer and the summer before, there were over 100 million Americans that were told to stay indoors because it was too hot outdoors. Yeah, there were warnings by the federal government that say you need to go indoors because the conditions outdoors are pretty lethal. So that's the reason why we are not dying so much. It's just because right now the government is becoming more preventive and people is becoming more aware of this. But again, that doesn't mean that the conditions outdoors are just not as lethal.
Well, we also had an Australian medical expert on the show saying that the nighttime temperatures can be critical, as well as the number of days of heat in a row, because somewhere we need time for the body's core temperature to cool down or we die. Did you encounter that factor in your study?
No. Yes, it is there, but specific information, we found only like maybe one or two papers about it. What makes this situation even more dangerous, especially on tropical places, is the issue of humidity. Right, so during the day, it's pretty hot because the sun is blasting right at you, right? So in places that are humid, obviously that heat evaporates the water. Now, at night, when the sun falls down, you still lack the heat from the sun, but unfortunately, as it gets colder, the humidity goes up because there is less temperature on the air. The temperature is colder. So what happens at night on many of these tropical places is that it's not necessarily the heat as much as it is the high humidity what then heats you at night. So you go from being hot all day long because during the daytime you get the high temperatures of the sun, and at night when there is no high temperatures of the sun, you get the high humidity of the evaporation and you still cannot cool down. So obviously this becomes like an endurance test that many people cannot endure because you just don't get a relief of it, not during the day, not during the night.
We mentioned seniors and people with medical conditions, but as you mentioned in your paper, babies and toddlers are really at risk during a heat wave. Why are their bodies more sensitive?
So on that paper, we actually make the case that this is something that could happen to anybody. Yeah, so obviously there is a much higher risk for this to happen to specific people like the elderly and the young. But that's not to say that healthy people like you or I or any young person is at risk from this. This can happen to even sport people playing outdoors. Now, but answering your question of the children, though, the reason why they are very vulnerable is because of their small bodies. The heat can get to them faster. So they heat up much faster than an adult will do simply because they are small bodies. Think about it. Like when you had a big potato and you want to cook it, you put it on the hot water, that big potato is going to take a long time for it to cook. Now, you put a small potato or you cook that potato in half, the big potato in half, that potato is going to cook much faster because the heat can get to the core much faster. So the issue is the same issue with children and with babies. It's the fact because their small body, whenever it's hot outdoors, that heat gets to them much faster than it will do to an adult just because of their size and volume.
Well, I'm sorry to ask this one, but we do need to face up to it. I'm wondering what it might feel like to be dying of heat. Would we even know that we are dying? I mean, we don't know we're at risk. Would we know that it's actually happening to us?
No, and in fact, most of the there is something called harvesting effect when it comes to heat waves, because you may still feel the heat, and these many of these physiological processes can be triggered, but you might not die right away. You know, you can die, for instance, with a broken liver, with a broken kidneys. You can live with that, and unfortunately, the death normally happens past the heat wave event, and that's what is called the harvesting effect, in which the mortality associated with these heat waves actually happen a few days, months, and at times years later after the heat wave, just because the organs got so damaged, they can still function, and so on, but eventually they will get you. So just going back to your question, it's just not safe to be on hot conditions for a very long period of time, because it will trigger these mechanisms. Again, that's just not to be scared of heat, because normally you have, the body has a very good defense to cool down from it. The problem is when you get exposed to it for a very long period of time, which happens during a heat wave, that you get exposed for two, three, at times up to 2 or 3 weeks of heat during these heat waves.
Well, you know, so far the world's only warmed about 1 degree C over pre-industrial times, and I'm having a hard time finding any scientist on the show who thinks we won't warm at least another degree during this century, and some say we will hit 3 degrees or more. Camilo Mora, given your study, what does this future look like?
Oh, no, this is not going to look pretty. Right now, this is the ag. I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, it's, I wish everybody in the United States and around the world will do a PhD on this to appreciate better the evidence and how bad this is and why scientists are so scared about this. You know, it's because when you look at the data and you study these cases, you realize how terrible this is. So as you point out, we are already heat up the planet by about 1 degree, and we found 2,000 heat waves since 1980 that had killed people. We found that 30% of the world's human population right now is exposed to deadly heat at least for 20 days a year. Now, what we are talking about is that if you fix climate change right now, the best we can, the Paris Agreement, even under the best case scenario, you're still going to allow the planet to warm up by 1 degree more. So right now, even the most optimistic people in the world, when it comes to science, had agreed that the planet will still heat up by one more degree. So if you keep in mind that 30% of the world's human population is exposed to deadly heat already, imagine then what it will be when you allow the planet to warm up by one more degree. Of course, this is not to say that we shouldn't do anything, because if you don't do anything, then the planet will warm up by 4 and 5 degrees Celsius more, and that could be the end of it.
Indeed. I think people in industrialized countries remain confident that science and technology will protect them. They don't believe the electricity will go out for a month or two, as it did in Puerto Rico. They think the government will save us, or maybe the military. I feel like we're fooling ourselves in a really dangerous way.
Yes. So there is a actually, this has been a story quite a lot. These ecological biases, that why is it that we don't take this more seriously? There is one of those biases that is called optimism bias. And basically what it points out is the fact that we normally, everybody thinks that bad things are happening. Obviously, you see them on TV, on the news, and sometimes you might even see them, but you always think that that's just going to happen to somebody else. And that optimism bias is what is preventing people of taking action on climate change, because while we appreciate that might be bad, it's something that is going to influence somebody else. When it comes to me, then I will worry about it. Unfortunately, that optimism bias is just a matter of time until it eventually gets to you. And the example that I will give you is exactly what you are talking about, Puerto Rico, or the people in Texas, or the people in Florida that were struck, every one of those, by individual hurricanes this past summer season. This is a storm season. I bet that if you went to Texas a year ago, most of these people will tell you that climate change is just going to happen somewhere else. It was a matter of time until it came knocking at their doors, and now you lost billions of dollars on that estate. But thanks God there were not many lives lost, but the damages and costs were massive until it eventually came and knocked at your door that climate change is real. So again, we live under this optimism bias that this is just going to happen to somebody else until eventually it gets to us. And at that moment, unfortunately, that optimism bias, unfortunately, what it's doing is delaying the solutions to fix this problem. And unfortunately, the longer we wait, the worse these things are going to be when they come.
So what are the next big questions for you, Camilo Mora? What are you going to be working on?
So right now, as a scientist, I mean, you go and look at the science of this. We have thousands of scientists, hundreds of scientific papers pointing out how bad this is. Personally, I think that it got the time for us to investigate how to fix this problem. A lot of scientists are trying to tackle these solutions to this problem at the government level, which is okay, don't get me wrong. But then it's very fragile solutions, just like what you had in the United States here. For many years, we have President Obama, who is a person that say, yeah, we are going to try to fix this. But then out of the blue, we had a person like President Trump that says, I don't believe on this, and he just goes and closes all of the regulations in place to prevent this from happening. So personally, I don't think the solution is going to come from the government. I think personally the solutions need to come from the people. People like you or me that start tackling this problem until it becomes a social norm in which every individual of our societies become aware of the footprint that we are having on our planet. And right now, that's one of the things that we are working hard on my lab, which is how do we ensure that people become aware of this footprint, the individual footprint, and what solutions are there so that every individual can clean up their footprint. Just like when you go to the beach, you produce garbage, but it's not like you're going to leave that garbage on the beach. You normally take it up and pick it up and put it on the garbage bin. So we want to do the same thing for climate change, that every individual, like you and me, we produce CO2, and figuring out the mechanisms for you to remove that CO2 from the air, not at the country level, not at the government level, but you as an individual. And that's one of the solutions that we are working on pretty hard on my lab.
We've been speaking with Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. He is the lead author of a new paper published in the American Heart Association Journal, which is titled Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality, and Outcomes. The title is 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. It is an open access paper, so you can search for that title or find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.org if you would like to read it. Camilo, thank you so much for providing this important science. We need it.
Thank you very much, Alex. A pleasure to be with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Still to come, the largest ever warning from world scientists about our rapidly deteriorating environment. Then a little younger hope of ways to adapt to extreme precipitation events. You may have heard or not heard that the great city of Athens, one of the oldest in the world, was pounded by rapid rains recently, streets filled deep with fast-moving mud. It's just another story from the new climate age. But cities can prepare, as we'll hear. First, here is a short vignette I've prepared with the help of Tiny Hands on YouTube. The first voice you know too well. But then we travel to Bonn, Germany, where a panel of American coal promoters are giving a government-approved push to include coal as part of reducing emissions. They want to help with climate change until a number of someones speak up.
Oh, good. Thank you, darling. I didn't know what the hell happened there. I thought they were the enemy, but they're my friends. Coal is coming back. Clean coal is coming back. 100%. Thank you. I'm so glad they said it. Today, I'm taking bold action to follow through on that promise. My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal, really clean coal.
Of all CO2 emissions, oil 34 and natural gas 25. The chart.
Those coal protesters in Bonn sang for sanity. They sang for us. 25 years ago, the scientists warned us humans are heading on a trajectory towards environmental disaster. 1,700 of them, including most of the Nobel Prize winners alive at the time, issued the World Scientists Warning to Humanity. It was 1992, the time of the famous Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Well, now our situation is much worse. More than 15,000 scientists from 184 countries have issued the World Scientists Warning to Humanity a second notice. It was just published November 13th in the journal Bioscience, and it's being echoed around the world media. William J. Ripple is the lead author. Dr. Ripple is a distinguished professor of ecology at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest and Ecosystems and Society. He's also a pretty well-known expert in biology and ecology generally. From Corvallis, Oregon, Bill Ripple, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, hello. Thank you, Alex.
Please tell us about that first warning from the world scientists back in 1992.
Well, back in 1992, the scientists got together, over 1,500 of them, and evaluated where humanity stands in terms of the environment. And they concluded that the trends were not good back then. And they wrote up this amazing letter to humanity, urging humans to change behavior and change course. So I ended up just happening along reading about their letter last February. And while I was reading it, I noticed that it has been 25 years exactly since they had written their document, and also that nowadays we have the ability to track environmental progress with these global data sets. So I thought, wow, it'd be interesting to chart it and see how we have done since 1992.
Well, that's a pretty scary process, really. I attended the Earth Summit in Rio in 92, and climate change, I knew about it, but it didn't stand out as much as things like air pollution and overfishing and just flat-out destruction of the ecosystem. You have to say that climate crisis has been one of the big shifts during these past 25 years.
Yes. In the 1992 document, they only mentioned climate change in passing because it just wasn't much of the conversation back then. So now when we plot our numbers with greenhouse gas emissions and the change in the surface temperature of the Earth, things are much different now 25 years later.
Well, yes, I think the big turning point for me was 2007 when the Arctic sea ice melted back so badly. That was a shock to the scientific community as well.
Yeah, I've been watching the climate scientists make predictions based on their models. And it seems very commonly that the scientists underestimated either the speed or the magnitude of the changing climate.
Well, 15,000 scientists, that's a lot of people. How did this giant call-out by scientists get started?
Well, I wrote my letter to humanity last spring and finished it by June. And then I was talking to a colleague, and I was saying, wow, I wonder if I should get some help and on this draft with some co-authors. And so I have several co-authors that helped me finalize the draft. But then before publishing, I talked to my colleague again, and I said, I wonder if we should try to get co-signatures on this by opening it up to other scientists. And at that point, he said, definitely, it'll have more power if you get others to sign on. So at that point, I just emailed the paper to 40 colleagues, and within 2 days, 1,200 scientists had signed. So at that point, I was just overwhelmed and astonished.
Well, that's the beauty of social media. We didn't have that back in 1992, and now things can really get rolling. I'd like to break this down a bit. You published 9 graphs of key indicators since 1960, and one of the simple things, the amount of forest cover on the planet has shown a steep decline. As a recognized expert in species, what does this forest cover drop-off mean for living things?
Well, forest is a very important habitat type on planet Earth. First of all, it provides for habitat for all types of other plants and animals, whether they're vertebrates or invertebrates. And we did have this 2.8% decline in total forest area over the last 25 years. That may sound like it's not a very high percentage, but if we keep losing our forest at this rate, we've lost a tremendous amount of habitat. And even maybe more importantly, these primary forests that are being lost to habitat destruction, more importantly, might be that we're losing a sink for carbon dioxide. So these forests store a lot of carbon, and it's just an essential habitat type to preserve.
And they're also a big part of our rainwater system and our water storage system. And your paper does show a huge drop in the amount of fresh water available for each human alive. Do we know, is that because the world population doubled since 1960, or is it due to water pollution, or what?
Yeah, we found fresh water per capita decreased significantly since 1992, about 26%. And we ran the numbers, and we attribute nearly all of that to the increase in the world population. So that's a major driver in the decrease in freshwater availability. But that said, at the same time, I would say that we have huge problems with freshwater habitat. This is a freshwater ecosystems is where a lot of the development by humans takes place. And this causes anything from alteration of stream channels to pollution in lakes and rivers. All types of activities go on along freshwater ways.
Well, again, Bill Ripple, you're a species scientist. What happened to biodiversity now in the last 25 years?
Yes, what we did is we plotted the abundance of vertebrate wildlife species since 1970, but also from 1992, we have a 28.9% decrease in the abundance of wild animals. Now, these are animals that are vertebrates. And this includes all types of species, including the ones that live in the oceans and the rivers and on terrestrial areas. So this variable is quite disturbing. That's a large drop-off just in the last 25 years.
Yeah, you know, many people assume our only risk is climate change. It is a big one, but if we could magically remove the climate threat from the world picture, I think we'd still be in big trouble, wouldn't we?
Yes, yeah, and that's what we show in our paper, that yes, climate change is significant, perhaps the most significant challenge that humanity is facing now, but we are also in the midst of a biodiversity crisis where many species of plants and animals are becoming rare, are becoming endangered, some are going extinct, and their populations are going down rapidly. So this we sometimes call a mass extinction event. You know, we've only had about six mass extinction events in the last 540 million years. So this is really a big deal. It's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. Once we start losing a lot of species, it does not bode well for humanity in general.
Well, we've talked about deforestation a bit and species loss and fresh water, and all those are partly the result of turning Earth into a gigantic pen for meat animals. What does this paper, with all its thousands of scientific signatories, say about the meat-driven agriculture?
Well, we did address that in the paper. We plotted the change in ruminant livestock for the globe since 1992. And ruminant livestock are the typically thought of as cattle, sheep, goats, domestic buffalo. And when we plotted that up, for ruminant livestock, we found a 20.5% increase in their numbers since 1992. So now, today, we're nearly 4 billion ruminants.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, your paper does talk about renewable energy as one of the solutions, and I'm wondering, is that like the answer, a big part of the answer, a small part of the total answer? What's your opinion?
I think renewable energy is very important for the issues surrounding climate change. So we need to have a non-carbon future in order to reduce emissions in future years. So renewable energy, I think, is a big part of what we need to do for mitigating climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. William J. Ripple from the Oregon State University. He's here representing more than 15,000 world scientists who just issued a stark warning to all of humanity. You know, I think, Bill, part of the problem is that very few people or governments want to talk about any of this. I mean, cutting back on meat, that's un-American. We all want our private cars. We want to fly anywhere, anytime. Christmas is coming. We have to shop. It's not polite to talk about birth control or climate change at work, at parties, or anywhere. How do we break through those silences in time?
Well, one of the objectives that we're trying to achieve with this letter to humanity is to increase people's awareness of the magnitude of the problem. So we put into 10 very simple charts what the trends are for various environmental and climate factors. So most everyone will be able to understand these simple charts, and they can see the trends themselves. So I think our first goal is to increase awareness with the general public. And then, secondly, I think that's important that once we have this type of understanding, a broader understanding of the scope of changes that are happening to the Earth's biosphere, that maybe there will be a groundswell of people who put pressure on their governments and their political leaders to make changes that will help in sustaining life on Earth into the future.
Well, you've studied the impact of having or not having major predators like wolves around. Surely we humans are the super predators on this planet. Do you sometimes see this widespread destruction we're talking about in terms of your studies?
Yes. Well, one way I think about it is, you know, I work in Yellowstone National Park, and we look at the linkages between wolves and their prey, and then the plants that the prey eat, and then the species that use those plants that the prey eat, like it goes from wolves to elk to aspen to birds and so on. So what we're able to see there is the interconnectedness of nature. And you can take this a step further and think about the interconnectedness of the entire of ecosystems within the entire biosphere. So, and humans are definitely the super predator here, and the responsibility lies with humanity in terms of presenting a sustainable future.
You know, this crisis is no longer something I personally can leave to governments. I'm struggling to get myself to change. Yesterday, I found myself driving when I could have taken my bike, even though I know about climate change. So I'm wondering, maybe we need some sort of self-shame or some mechanism that gets each one of us to do our bit, what we really could do.
Oh, that's a good point. And what we're hoping to accomplish with our letter to humanity is an example just like you give, that people start thinking about ways that we can provide incentives for individuals to change their behavior. So this letter is just an opening of a conversation, and we want a global debate and conversation about what can we do next. So we only wrote 1,200 words here, and we are not able to save the world in 1,200 words. We're just definitely starting the conversation.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up with that. That's a pretty good way of putting it. And I just want to tell listeners that this was published November 13th in the journal Bioscience. And you can easily look it up by just searching in any engine, World Scientists Warning to Humanity, a Second Notice. And I'll also put links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org, coming out every Wednesday. We've been talking with William J. Ripple, and he's from Oregon State University, and he's the lead author of that paper. Bill Ripple, thank you for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
In the summer of 2017, the heaviest rainfall in a century hit the German capital of Berlin. It was another of the extreme rainfall events striking around the planet. In Berlin, streets and buildings flooded, but it could have been worse. Berlin is making itself, well, it's trying to make itself into a sponge city. As climate disruption becomes real, China is planning on building 30 of them. I found that out from Chelsea Goad. If Bill Gates is building a new smart city or technology is emerging to move you 10 times faster, that is Chelsea Goad's beat. She is a science journalist and associate editor at Futurism.com. Chelsea, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is a sponge city?
So there's no single definitive exact blueprint for what a sponge city is. But generally speaking, a sponge city is a city in which technological measures are taken to reduce flooding specifically. So there will be rooftop gardens, extra planting. Oftentimes, a main element of the building or creation of sponge cities is that traditional asphalt and concrete are replaced by much more porous substances so that you might be driving down the street normally, but if it were to flood, if there were a monsoon, that same material will be able to absorb, you know, 10, 50 times more water. So the general concept of a sponge city is literally a city that can soak up water.
Well, yeah, I know that the hard city phenomenon was partly what sunk Houston in Hurricane Harvey. They just kept building suburbs there, replacing surrounding fields, paved everything over, and people's homes have huge driveways. Some folks pave the whole yard to avoid all that mowing. It seems like we've kind of designed ourselves into a bad corner just as extreme rainfall events arrive. What do you think?
I completely agree. This is really happening. You know, the extreme flooding is becoming much more of an issue in more densely populated urban areas. That's why China is investing so heavily in the creation of sponge cities, because in more rural areas, you will have, you know, fields, farms that naturally soak up water. But in a city, it's much more difficult, and then it becomes much more treacherous and much higher risk. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that at the same time we're having such increased growth of urban areas, we're also having this severe increased risk of continuing extreme weather and flooding.
And since Victorian times, the old way of city design was just to keep building more underground pipes and carry all that water away somewhere. Of course, Houston, their water reservoirs totally filled up. There was no somewhere to put it. So I guess we're going to have to change away from that and just keep what we get.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to really rethink a lot of how we structure and build from a very elementary root level.
And I saw in a Bloomberg video that Berlin is doing a lot of green rooftops, and they also do swales, as they call them, where the water can kind of collect. I was starting to wonder, though, if you collect a lot of rainfall, doesn't that open it up for mosquitoes, or am I just worrying too much?
That is a definitive possibility, but that also depends on the climate of the region that you're in. So Berlin, you know, if they start collecting rainwater, I don't think overnight it's going to become a tropical ecosystem and malaria will run rampant. But it is something that 10, 20 years down the line might require more consideration, and maybe that won't turn out to be the most fruitful technology.
So your article is titled, China's Building 30 Sponge Cities to Soften the Blow of Climate Change. Are the Chinese planning to build 30 new cities, or are they going to retrofit the existing cities?
Currently, with existing plans, they're retrofitting existing cities. So they're taking cities that already have an increased risk of issues of flooding, so cities that are, you know, generally fairly populated or relatively urban, and they're outfitting them with different methods that, you know, would pertain to a sponge city. But, you know, again, each of them would do that in a different way, depending on the needs of the region.
Well, China has a lot of reason to get going on this. They were drenched with extreme rainfalls last summer, just like Berlin, and they had landslides and floods that killed more people. And according to The Economist magazine, the number of floods in Chinese cities has at least doubled since 2008. I wonder, you know, there's not going to be enough emergency funds to patch all this up. Maybe the world will experience kind of the Puerto Rico phenomenon where it takes a long time to recover. Do you think we can plan our way out of this, Chelsea?
I think the only way to plan our way out of this is really by drastically reducing emissions and taking a much more aggressive stance against the continuation and pressing on of climate change, because, you know, we're solving the symptoms. These are the symptoms of the illness, and the underlying illness here is climate change. And, you know, our world, the world that we've known, is changing more rapidly and more drastically than we really are equipped to handle at this moment. So, unfortunately, these increased natural disasters are a symptom of that existing reality that we're already in. So, you know, that isn't something that we can circumvent unless we really get to the root of the issue. So, unfortunately, we might be dealing with a lot more of that type of disaster until we really make some more headway.
Well, I agree, but we can try and make things a bit better. And one really cool aspect of sponge cities is that they can literally help cool down those urban heat islands. I'm wondering, I guess it's just the combination of water and plants that help cool a city down as the climate heats up?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of sponge cities, it really is that simple. When you kind of take an urban environment and you introduce those, you know, natural elements that kind of draw in the water very literally, it naturally cools the local environment. And it's simple, but it works.
You write about the future as though we're going to have one, and it may even have some good things about it, and that's refreshing for my crowd. Do you think that humans are going to be able to adapt to climate change? You've sort of addressed this somewhat, but I mean, are you a more positive person or not?
I think I'm relatively optimistic about it. I think that humans are uniquely innovative. We'll find our way out of really any issue, but I think it's a matter of collectively understanding what the issue is and what needs to be done. Because individual efforts are incredible, but if the entire globe isn't working together, it's going to be difficult. So yes, I do believe that, you know, we can fight our way out of this situation. I don't necessarily agree with Stephen Hawking that within the next couple hundred years we'll have to completely leave Earth. but it is a difficult situation. It's not going to be easy.
Well, Chelsea, while we have you here, what is Bill Gates up to in Arizona?
Well, Bill Gates has found himself roughly 25,000 acres of land, kind of a straight shot to Las Vegas, and he wants to build a smart city, set up kind of like a regular city. I don't know if it's going to be a sponge city yet, but, you know, I could assume that those elements might be introduced. And from what is publicly understood right now, it's going to be almost like a testing ground for technology. It's going to be a regular working city with residential areas and offices and schools, but it's going to have introduced to it a lot of more futuristic technologies that we wouldn't normally see in our day-to-day lives. So we'll see what happens with that.
Well, hopefully it's not all run on Windows 10 anyway. your other persona, though, you're a musician. Chelsea, where can people find your music?
Well, my band actually just released our first studio single on Spotify. So the band name is Foxanne, F-O-X-A-N-N-E. And yeah, we're really excited about it. I didn't know you knew that. That's very exciting.
Is that Queen of the Lost Boys? Is that the song?
Yes, it is. And it's the first off of our upcoming record.
I heard it on SoundCloud, and I like it. We've been talking about sponge cities and the future in these times of climate change. Our guest is futurism journalist Chelsea Goad. You can find her on Twitter at Chelsea_Goad, and that's spelled G-O-H-D. And you can get the latest at futurism.com. Chelsea, thanks so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
We've used up all there is. Please listen again next week to Radio EcoShock. Let's go out with just a small sample from Chelsea Gode's new release, Queen of the Lost Boys.
Call me Sun's Song. Call me Queen of the Lost Boys. It was me who was lost all alone. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Few meetings today with a couple of members of Congress. One of the things that we said was, hey, we're here not to tell you to stop bad legislation, but we're here with some good legislation.
They are trying to put me in jail for resisting the occupation peacefully. They want to shut my voice. They don't want me to do anything to help my community.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up in one moment, an interview with Issa Amro, human rights defender and co-founder of the activism group Youth Against Settlements. He talks about being on trial in an Israeli military court and facing 18 charges against him. His first court date was on October 29th, and the second one is scheduled for late December. But first, we spoke with Jennifer Bing and Brad Parker of the No Way to Treat a Child campaign about a historic piece of legislation they helped encourage U.S. Congress members to introduce on November 14th. This is Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We now go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Jennifer Bing of the American Friends Service Committee and Brad Parker, attorney with Defense for Children International Palestine. Jennifer and Brad have been working as part of the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, which aims to end Israel's military detention and abuse of some 700 Palestinian children each year. Earlier today, as we record this interview on Tuesday, November 14th, 10 members of Congress introduced a historic bill that would bar the U.S. from financially supporting human rights abuses of Palestinian children by the Israeli military. The Promoting Human Rights by Ending Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act was brought to the floor by Democratic Representative Betty McCollum of Minnesota. Jennifer and Brad, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Jennifer, let's start with you. It's a monumental day there on Capitol Hill as this bill becomes the first ever to prioritize the human rights of Palestinian children as a condition for U.S. support. Tell us about the bill and what it's been like to see it being introduced into Congress today.
Well, it was really exciting. What can I say? You know, it's hard to imagine just a few years ago that we, when we started this campaign, we just didn't imagine that we would have legislation 3 years out. People have really worked hard to educate at the grassroots level, sending in messages, attending briefings, doing all sorts of things to let their members of Congress know that this is an issue that concerns Americans, particularly people who've been to the region and seen things firsthand. So, yeah, I mean, we had a few meetings today with a couple of members of Congress, people who haven't quite committed to signing on to the bill. And one of the things that we said was, hey, we're here not to tell you to stop bad legislation, but we're here with some good legislation. So that just, I don't know, I've been doing this for so long, and to be able to say that, I just, wow, I didn't think it would be in my lifetime, honestly.
Brad, tell us about the significance of this bill, which goes after USAID to Israel, specifically on the basis of Israel's abuses of Palestinian children in military detention.
The bill itself, I think, is it's a huge success in kind of integrating a rights-based approach to policy towards Israel and Palestine. It really does set the standard as international law that Israel should be held to. And so, you know, the bill works to prohibit military aid going to the Israeli government that furthers or supports a range of violations, including ill treatment and torture of Palestinian child detainees, administrative detention, the use of isolation for interrogation purposes, the denial of access to attorneys during interrogation, denial of parental preservation. It really works to make sure that U.S. taxpayer funds are not being used and are not complicit in these widespread systematic institutionalized violations that Palestinian children face. So, the bill, I think, is very tight and narrow and focused in the sense that it's really trying to use transparency as an accountability mechanism. And it's not cutting or adjusting the total military aid. I think it's important to point that out, because what it really is doing is just holding accountable in some ways as Americans for the support we give to make sure it's in line with international law, but also holding, the Israeli government accountable to everything that they've obligated themselves to when it comes to international law regarding juvenile justice standards that they've signed on to as the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and kind of these basic due process guarantees and protections that are systematically sort of thrown out the door in the military detention system for children. So I think it, aside from sort of being first ever bill and historic, it's, the first ever bill and historic as well, because it's a very concrete, direct piece of legislation that's something to be excited about. So I think that we're seeing that through, the co-sponsors that we've been able to gather up until this point. And then I think the 17 or 18 humanitarian, human rights, and faith-based organizations that have signed on as endorsing organizations behind the legislation. So it is a special moment, and I think we'd have a lot of work ahead for sure. But it is, as Jennifer said, I think a bit of a watershed moment where we are driving the agenda in some small way with a proactive vehicle that gives us kind of a long-term mechanism to really create space to talk about rights violations that are inherent in now 50 years of occupation.
That's the voice of Brad Parker of Defense for Children International and the No Way to Treat a Child campaign. Also with us is Jennifer Bang of the American Friends Service Committee. Can actually, if both of you could comment on the next steps for this bill as it moves forward in Congress on Capitol Hill, what is most important? What's the timing like right now? How can people advocate to support this bill and get their representatives to sign on to it?
Well, given that we have 10 signers and there are over 400 members of the House of Representatives, there's a lot that people can do. Of course, the first thing is to send out a letter to your member of Congress and find out if they signed on to thank them and when they haven't, which is, of course, the majority of people, to start to engage in an important conversation about rights. With one member of staff member that we met with today was leafing through the bill to try to find something in it that would be objectionable, that would somehow, you know, taint it, you know, oh, well, this won't stand. And he kept looking and he couldn't find anything. And to me, that's a pat on the back to all the people who put so much hard work into writing this bill and making it airtight, making it based on documentation that can't be refuted. And those are the kind of conversations that we have to have with our elected officials and with opinion shapers in this country. And I'm excited that it's starting to happen, but clearly we have a long way to go. You know, in the news every day, there are Army night raids that are continuing. There are still children in detention. There are still these abuses happening. So, you know, while we're celebrating for sure that we are seeing movement, you know, it's, the situation's dire.
I think one thing that I'd just add is that I think the long-term piece of it is key. You know, I think a lot of the time the Palestinian rights movement broadly is reactionary. You know, things are happening to Palestinians. There's sort of dire things happening on the ground in Gaza, in Jerusalem, throughout the West Bank, wherever it might be. Right, that's sort of the daily crushing sort of grind of occupation. And to have something proactive, it shifts the burden a bit. So I think mobilizing people locally to engage with their members of Congress is something that with the No Way to Treat a Child campaign we support people to do. But I think also having something that's proactive and you know puts the rights-based approach out there that we want to be sort of the center to engage people throughout the U.S., I think it just has such a broader reach than a lot of the sort of defensive reactionary work that we've been forced to do because it's important and necessary. But I think having the sort of added value of something that's proactive and really meant to drive the conversation and put it in a place that allows a broader range of people and voices to be brought into the movement really helps sustain and grow and build and do the political work that's really necessary.
This bill and this issue of Palestinian children in Israeli military detention is something that isn't in the headlines every day. And it is something that has been going on for decades. And yet when we started this campaign, we were surprised by how few people, even those who read Electronic Intifada, who are involved in the Palestinian solidarity movement, weren't aware of exactly what the kind of routine nature, the systemic nature of this, of these practices by the Israeli army. So I think that too has been a great learning for us in trying to describe to a general public about what it means to live under occupation, what it means to live under military law, what it's like to be without due process rights. You know, there are communities in the United States that can relate to those issues through their own experiences, and it gives us an opportunity to connect with those communities and joint struggles and joint solidarity. At the same time, you know, we do educate ourselves and our communities, and we become better advocates, I think.
Jennifer Vang, if people want to learn more about the Promoting Human Rights by Ending Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act, or want to get involved with the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, how can they do that?
Well, the first thing, they should go to our website, which is easy to remember, nowaytotreatachild.org. And on that site, there are lots of resources that people can utilize. There'll also be, there is an action alert where people can use a tool to send letters to the member of Congress. And we also, later in the month, will be having a webinar for people learn more about the campaign and how to get involved. And so that will be also announced. So the most important thing is to sign up on our nowaytotreatachild.org website.
Great. And we will, of course, be following this bill as it moves through the House of Representatives and hopefully onto the Senate floor. Jennifer Vang and Brad Parker, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up in one moment, Issa Amro. Stay tuned.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, who examines the proposed Trump GOP tax reform plan's major cuts to Medicare and reductions in Social Security benefits through changes in the Consumer Price Index. Art Tandarup, a Nebraska farmer and activist with the anti-Keystone XL pipeline group Bold Nebraska, who reflects on state regulators' recent approval of the pipeline project, maintaining that the fight is far from over. And Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, who explains why there's growing opposition to FCC moves that will allow the right-wing Sinclair TV network to merge with Tribune Media. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On November 6th, the Trump administration announced that in January 2019, it will end temporary protected status, or TPS, that was given to 5,300 Nicaraguan immigrants that protects them from deportation. The White House also said the program would be extended for some 86,000 Honduran immigrants until July 2018, but added it could then be terminated. Thousands of Nicaraguans and Hondurans were given the special status in 1999 after Hurricane Mitch devastated Central America. On November 20th, The Trump administration also announced 59,000 Haitians living in the U.S. must leave within 18 months. Brooklyn Congresswoman Yvette Clark is leading a bipartisan drive to give a total of 300,000 people with temporary protected status in the United States an opportunity to win permanent residency. Representative Clark is co-sponsoring what's called the Aspire Act, along with Miami Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton and Seattle Democrat Pramila Jayapal. The bill would provide permanent residency to anyone who had been granted TPS as of January 2017. An overwhelming majority of Central Americans living in the U.S. on TPS are employed full-time and made major contributions to the U.S. economy through payment of income and property taxes, Social Security and Medicare contributions, job creation, and spending. The Center for American Progress estimates the termination of temporary protected status would cost the U.S. economy $164 billion over a decade. Amid continuing fallout from the 2016 Brexit vote, there is growing concern in Britain over allegations of covert Russian influence in UK elections, with a discovery of over 400 fake Twitter accounts run by the Russian Internet Research Agency. According to the Guardian newspaper, Russian-based social media trolls sought to exploit ethnic divisions in the United Kingdom as citizens voted over their future relationship with the European Union. After this year's March terrorist attack on Westminster Bridge, one of the Kremlin-linked accounts sought to stir up anti-Muslim anger. Fake social media posts like this were picked up by mainstream newspapers, including the Daily Mail and The Sun. Conservative and Labour members of Parliament are putting pressure on Twitter and Facebook to identify the phony accounts used to influence the Brexit vote. Many of the fake pro-Brexit Twitter accounts from Russia purported to be from conservative Americans, including a U.S. Navy War veteran and a Republican from Tennessee. While Russian President Vladimir Putin denied any attempt to influence the Brexit referendum, Western analysts say Putin will benefit from a weakened EU, which will be more reluctant to impose economic sanctions against Russia for past and future aggression, such as the annexation of Crimea. For the past 8 months, 1,800 former Time Warner Cable employees in New York City have been on strike over a contract dispute with Charter Communications. Union activists say Charter is trying to eliminate valued benefits. For years, Local 3 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers had a good relationship with Time Warner, which provided quality health insurance coverage and a generous 401k retirement plan. However, when Charter bought Time Warner Cable in May 2016 and absorbed it under its Spectrum Cable and Internet arm, the relationship soured. Charter, which employs some 90,000 people across the U.S., moved to switch its Time Warner Cable employees over to their boilerplate contract with much fewer benefits, triggering the strike. Under Time Warner, workers enjoyed low co-pays and premiums for major medical expenses, and the union leadership says it's not ready to give up on quality health benefits for their members to end the strike. Meanwhile, many striking workers must rely on food pantry donations to make ends meet and struggle to pay rent and mortgages, with a looming threat for some of homelessness. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
According to the calculations of many economists, President Trump and the Republicans' proposed tax reform legislation, which passed in the House November 16th and now moves to the Senate, will primarily benefit the top 1% of wealthiest Americans and not the middle class as advertised. In fact, by some estimates, 80% of the benefits from GOP tax reductions and tax code changes would go to people making more than $730,000 a year over the next decade. Other features of the Republican tax plan include elimination of the estate tax that only benefits couples with more than $11 million in assets, ending most tax deductions for college students, dropping deductions for state and local taxes, predominantly hurting blue state residents, and repeal of the Obamacare individual mandate, in the Senate version of the tax bill that will result in 13 million Americans losing their health insurance coverage. But while many of the effects of the GOP tax reform plan operate like Robin Hood in reverse, another set of negative consequences for average Americans relates to little-discussed cuts in the federal social safety net. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the GOP tax bill will instantly trigger $400 billion in automatic cuts to Medicare over the next 10 years, including a $25 billion reduction in the first year after enactment. Your reporter spoke with Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, who examines the proposed Trump GOP tax plan's major cuts to Medicare and the likelihood that something called chain CPI will be imposed through the tax bill, increasing taxes and reducing Social Security benefits.
The Republicans have really just one play in their playbook that they've been using over and over again since January 1, and that is what they want to do is give tax breaks to their billionaire donors. And they, in the process, even though they say there will be cuts to middle class, many middle class families will see their taxes increase. The way they want to pay for those huge tax cuts for the very wealthy is by cutting vital programs. They want to really end Medicare and Medicaid as we know it. They have had a vendetta against Social Security really since the time it's been enacted. And what they did over the summer with Trump Care was they were really going to destroy Medicaid, get rid of the Affordable Care Act, and use that to pay for big tax cuts. And now they're just doing that in reverse order. They passed a budget that has big cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and tax breaks for the very wealthy. They've now passed through the House a tax cut bill that will by itself automatically trigger what CBO calls $400 billion of cuts in Medicare over the next decade. People are not really talking about it, but as soon as the tax bill gets passed, unless they waive another provision of an existing law, there will be $400 billion of cuts in Medicare. They also wanted, in the Senate version, repeal a part of Obamacare that, again, CBO projects will cut $185 billion out of Medicaid.
Nancy, with these hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts that may come out of Medicare, what will the net effect be on Medicare recipients down the line? How will it affect them personally?
Well, I think one way it may affect them is their choice of doctor. All these cuts in reimbursement of doctors and so forth, a lot of doctors may decide that it's not in their economic interest to keep seeing Medicare patients, and Medicare patients can wind up not being able to go to the hospitals they want, not being able to go to the doctors they want. The problem is that if this bill passes, it automatically triggers these cuts, and the person in charge of figuring out how to implement the cuts will be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. That's a man by the name of Mick Mulvaney, who is an extreme conservative who has a longstanding hatred of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and he will be in charge of deciding how the Medicare cuts come about. And as a consequence, I'm concerned that he will come up with the most destructive ways possible because he wants to see this program ended.
And Nancy, before we go, I wanted to make sure to talk about another situation that's waiting in the wings here, again, not being much discussed, and that is there's a proposal by the Republicans to include something called chain CPI in the final tax legislation, which could increase taxes for many Americans, but also mean future reductions in Social Security benefits. Tell our listeners a bit about chain CPI. I'm sure many haven't heard about it.
It is an absolute tax increase, and it does have this potential for Social Security, as you mentioned. One of the big advantages of Social Security over private pension plans is that the benefits are indexed, so they don't erode over time. As inflation goes up, the benefits go up, so the purchasing power is maintained. Now, the same thing is true on the tax side, that the brackets are indexed so that if you're getting more dollars, but it's the real value of that money is not increasing, you don't pay a higher percentage in taxes, which is why the brackets are indexed. When they first decided to have automatic increases in 1972, there was only one index available. That was the consumer price index for workers. And so that was used. Now, of course, retirees, people who get Social Security, are by definition not workers, yet that was the only index that was available then. The current inflation adjustment, the CPIW as it's called, for Social Security is inadequate because seniors and people with disabilities have disproportionately large expenditures on health care. And health care costs have risen much more rapidly than other costs. So there's another index called CPIE, the Consumer Price Index for Elderly, that is a better measure. But instead of going for the CPIE, in order to save money, politicians a few years ago said, well, let's use a stingier index, and that's this chain CPI. They're now saying, well, let's use the stingier index for taxes, and that will cause middle class and working class people to pay higher income taxes. And what many fear is that once they get a foothold on the taxes, it'll be easy to say, well, we're using it for this, let's use it for Social Security too. And that would be a cut in Social Security benefits.
That was Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, chair of the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, and author of The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. For more analysis on the GOP tax reform bill's impact on working families, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 16th, at least 210,000 gallons of tar sands oil spilled in South Dakota from the Keystone Pipeline. The pipeline, owned by TransCanada, is the same company that's trying to build yet another pipeline, the infamous Keystone XL, which, if built, would bring tar sands oil from indigenous lands in Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas for likely export. The spill occurred just days before Nebraska's Public Service Commission had to rule on TransCanada's application for the KXL through the state. The project, which was denied a permit by President Obama in 2015, was revived by an executive order signed by Donald Trump in one of his first official acts in office. On November 20th, the Public Service Commission announced their approval of the pipeline by a 3-2 vote, but changed 60% of the route through Nebraska, which means the company must now deal with a whole new set of challenges. Another major obstacle for the company is that the price of oil has dropped by more than 50% since TransCanada first proposed the project over a decade ago. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Art Tanderup, a Nebraska farmer and member of Bold Nebraska, a group that's been fighting the pipeline through legal challenges, grassroots organizing, and the construction of several solar-powered buildings along the proposed pipeline route. Here, Tanderup, whose farm is located on both the earlier and newly approved route, maintains that despite the commission decision, the fight is far from over.
We're disappointed in the decision that it wasn't a total rejection, obviously. However, TransCanada did not get their preferred route. And in the application process, part of that process requires two alternative routes. So they had put the first route that they had tried several years ago and was rejected, as well as they came up with this alternative one, and the Public Service Commission chose to go to this alternate route. However, it still crosses the eastern sandhills up here through the most porous soils where the Ogallala Aquifer will be most directly impacted if there's a spill. We have a situation that now is going to require TransCanada to make a decision. What do they do next? Nobody was smiling when they came out of that hearing yesterday, and their statements from corporate are pretty indecisive. They need money to build this, and they also need suppliers, and they don't have either of those yet. And the decision that was made yesterday is going to increase the amount of money that they need. For example, on the preferred route that they've been trying to get, they already have purchased land for substations. They have a lot of easements purchased. A lot of infrastructure has already been put in place, even though they have no permits for this. So consequently, nothing has been done on this other route. They haven't talked to any of these landowners, a whole bunch of new landowners, 7 more counties they have to go through, 4 pumping stations that they've had no preparation for. Even though it wasn't a total victory, it was a win. So another thing that they can do is they could appeal the decision that was made. They could appeal that, which would go to a district court, which would be in front of one judge. Whatever that one judge decides would then probably go forth to the Nebraska Supreme Court. If they decide to work with what the Public Service Commission approved, then we're looking, I think, at least 3 to 5 years, legal challenges, etc. And time is obviously on our side with tar sands pipelines, because every day, every year, is one step closer to more renewable energy, and we don't need the dirty fossil fuels.
Art Tanderup, just days before the Public Service Commission in Nebraska had to make this decision, there was a huge oil spill along the Keystone Pipeline, also owned by TransCanada, which has been in operation for several years, at least 210,000 gallons. And a lot of us thought that that would actually help move the decision to a denial of the permit to build the KXL. And then I learned that there's a law in Nebraska since 2011 that prevents the commission from even considering safety issues when considering these pipeline applications.
This is politics at work in its finest, where you have TransCanada who influences people who make the laws and who write the rules. And so that is something they got in there. They also have in their rules that they can't go through the porous soils like we have on my farm. There's another part of it that talks about threats to natural resources. And in Nebraska, that aquifer is our greatest resource. So this pipeline is a threat. Even though you can't talk about spills, that pipeline is still a threat to that natural resource. So it gets very tricky. You know, we've been battling that issue all along as we fought this through the Public Service Commission.
That was Art Tanderup, a Nebraska farmer and activist with the group Bold Nebraska. For more news and perspectives on the fight to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On a 3-2 party line vote on November 16th, the Federal Communications Commission voted to eliminate a series of decades-old regulations that will now allow broadcasters to merge with newspapers in the same market and could permit companies to own 2 of the top 4 stations in a city. If they survive an expected court challenge and opposition by consumers, the rules will usher in a new era of concentration of media ownership that critics charge will harm the diversity of views heard on the air and read in print. The major beneficiary of the FCC's deregulation is Sinclair Broadcast Group, the conservative television corporation seeking to buy Tribune Media Company, that owns 42 stations, for $3.9 billion. If the Tribune Media merger goes forward, Sinclair would own a total of 223 TV stations serving 108 markets, including 39 of the top 50, which reach about 72% of all U.S. households. Sinclair, which already is the nation's largest TV station group owner, has a reputation for forcing local stations to air conservative commentaries and run stories with a right-wing bias on the local news. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press. Here he discusses why he believes the recent FCC vote that removes limits on media ownership will harm the public interest, and indications that the Trump administration may have struck a special deal with Sinclair to approve the merger in exchange for favorable political coverage.
Yeah, it really is a scandalous
set of activities being carried out by the Federal Communications Commission. There are longstanding rules on the books that haven't changed at all since the early 2000s. And really, the majority has been held in place since the late 90s, you know, going back in some cases back to the 1970s, limits put on how many television stations one company can own in a market, just how big a footprint one company can have when it comes to local news. And as we know, still the biggest sources for local news are those local broadcasters, your daily newspaper, even in the internet age, when it comes to who's actually got reporters out there doing stories, looking what's happening in the community. It's really dominated by these local outlets. And so the FCC has long had rules saying, hey, we can't have more than one company owning too much media in one market. And there's going to be limits on how many TV stations, what the reach of those TV stations is anyway, across the country as a whole. But ever since the Trump administration came in and the GPI, they've been hammering away at these longstanding limits. And so just last week, they actually voted in a really, unfortunately, sorely undercovered vote to get rid of a bunch of the rules, all designed to benefit this company, Sinclair. There's no question about it. Sinclair has been one of the companies that's been pushing hardest to change these rules, that's been coming up with ways to evade them, and they've now convinced the FCC to do away with the rules that are standing in their way, and in some cases actually reinstate rules that the Obama administration got rid of that were putting limits on how much they could own. So it's a situation where now there is nothing standing in the way of a single television company like Sinclair outright owning two or three stations in a market, no matter how small it is. They've changed the standard by which they would consider waivers among the top-rated stations. So you could own, you know, CBS and ABC or NBC and Fox. That had been prohibited. Now they'll look at it on a case-by-case basis. They've also blessed these so-called sidecar arrangements where a company essentially runs the news operations of one of the other stations. So you're now looking at a situation where one company could control maybe five or six television stations in a given market and start to set themselves up where you only really have one or two dominant voices. They also got rid of limits that said you couldn't own the daily newspaper and a television station or a radio station in the same market. They've absolutely wiped that away. And if you listen to what Sinclair and companies like it actually tell their investors, this is their vision. Very little competition. They want to be able to swap stations with other big chains, swallow up the middle-sized chains, and basically dominate in any given community or in a region where you have one company doing most of the news. And when it comes to Sinclair, they've managed to make it even worse because Sinclair is a company that's notorious for slipping conservative and right-wing propaganda into its newscasts.
Describe for our listeners the Sinclair TV operation, who owns it, and their political spin applied to local news coverage.
Sure. Sinclair started out as a family-owned station in Baltimore that has rapidly expanded over the last several decades. And the head of the company is a guy named David Smith. It's still in his family, but now they already own more than 170 stations all across the country. If they get this deal done, they'll own more than 230 stations because they're trying to take over Tribune, which owns television stations all across the country, including in the biggest markets, bigger markets than Sinclair's ever been in, like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. But Sinclair is sort of notorious for pushing a, you know, right-wing or reactionary agenda. You know, they make Fox News look moderate in terms of their political coverage. Now, most of their broadcasts will look to you like any other newscast, you know, sports and weather and, you know, here's something that happened locally. But they force all of their stations all across the country, no matter if it's Seattle or San Antonio or Oklahoma City or Salt Lake City, they force them all to run conservative commentary. There are no liberal commentators, no progressive commentators on Sinclair broadcast, but they force everybody to carry conservative commentary from people like Armstrong Williams, who ran Ben Carson's campaign, and a guy named Boris Epstein, who is a Donald Trump campaign spokesperson, who, you know, on broadcasts across Sinclair stations just about every day is out there to deliver conservative talking points. And they've also slipped this sort of conservative slant into a lot of their newscasts. You might not get it on the local stories, but they now run, essentially a national news operation. Sinclair has been very friendly to the Trump administration. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, suggested that they had a deal with Sinclair for sort of favorable and uncut coverage during the campaign. So now we have a network that essentially operates as Trump TV being offered huge, huge regulatory favors worth billions of dollars, with the FCC leading the way.
That was Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about opposition to the Sinclair Tribune TV merger and the FCC's deregulation of media ownership rules by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Great nation. Let me ask you something. Is there something in the water? In the last few days, we've seen more shocks than an electric eel. Women are popping up like dandelions after a summer rain, recounting deeply submerged memories of attacks, indecencies, and assaults, many from decades ago. Why now? I think many, many women awoke during the massive, unprecedented Women's March against Trump during the spring. It was, according to my research, the biggest demo and protest in American history. I think the demo gave many women a sense of their potential power, a sense of their feminine strength. That awakening led to a sense of how women could command social space, social power, especially in the area of social interaction. That which once led to social silence now leads to social outrage and perhaps, social change. In this supposed democracy, women are rarely ever a political majority. Why aren't they the majority of Congress, of mayors, of judges, or DAs? Why don't they control the councils, boards of education, businesses, churches? Perhaps this isn't a democracy after all. For it would be insane to beat, assault, disparage, or rape that segment of the population that constitute its very majority, right? Unless this population has been socially, psychologically intimidated, quietly accepting their subordinate status, unless they were conditioned from their earliest days as girls to play nice with their very abusers and assailants, unless they were trained to see themselves as less than their brothers, fathers, and men generally, unless they were mistaught so that when they are raped, abused, diminished, it is their fault, for they were now somehow unclean. Until day breaks, and on a sunlit morn in January, millions of women take to the streets and see for once their immense power. Movements such as these do far more than change minds. They can change nations. From imprisoned nation, from rape nation. This is Mumia Abdul-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Malik Khaldun. I'm calling in from Indiana at Wabash Valley Correctional Facility. I'm submitting a piece called Queen Tamika Mallory, Keeping Up the Example of Strong Black Female Power by Kalfani Malik Khaldun. I'm consciously encouraged by the collective work and action being taken by the women of Black Lives Matter, Mothers of the Movement, and organizers of the Women's March. We love you, Tamika Mallory. Revolutionary love and a 21-gun salute to new African black women all around this country. I am so proud of you for having the courage and hope to believe that female power and unity is even possible. My beautiful new African black sister, Tamika Mallory, please know that although I am confined to a prison cell 23, 24 hours a day here in Indiana, I have followed your work and activities. I have had debates about how you had to be the target of American white supremacy and blatant racism for having the courage and energy to openly speak truth to power in the face of raw and uncut hatred and ignorance. Traditionally, as a new African nation, our women have blazed a trail that demanded recognition from having put in excellent work. This work has been responsible for pushing our liberation struggle forward, from Black Lives Matter to the Million Women's March. Tamika Mallory, you and Alicia Garza, Tiffany Dana Lofton, Bree Newsom, Jamaica Burley, Angela Peoples, Marilyn Zuniga represent our communities today just as powerfully as Harriet Tubman, Betty Shabazz, Bell Hooks, Coretta Scott King, Winnie Mandela, Sojourner Truth, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Angela Davis, as well as Assata Shakur, did in the past. You have so many strong examples to draw your encouragement from. Young new African black women are now joining Black Lives Matter and envisioning creating their own female organizations or groups, because as a collective body, you and us are strong and represent a force to be heard and reckoned with. Today we can expose all forms of bigotry, sexism, oppression on all levels, and gender discrimination. The Conrads here in Indiana, the Department of Corrections, the Universal Urban Gorillas, and the Indiana DOC Watch on the inside love you, Tamika Mallory, and all the sisters and women who stand in solidarity with you. We love you and stand in complete solidarity with all of you who are on the front line today. Keep the movement growing and leading by example. Power to the people. Prison lives matter too. The struggle continues. Brother Kalfani Malik Khaldun, Leonard McQuay, 874304, Post Office Box 1111, Carlisle, Indiana, 47838. Peace.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Were there authentic pro-democracy ideals underpinning the Euromaidan movement in Ukraine? And were those ideals realized? How did the Maidan uprising in late 2013 and early 2014 compare with the Donbass uprisings which would follow? What factors are shaping the international community's response to the Ukraine crisis? Are Western imperial ambitions undermining the Minsk ceasefire agreement? What does the future hold for Ukraine? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we explore some of the history and background of the four-year-old Ukraine crisis with noted scholar and writer Ruslan Zarazov. We will also hear from Canadian writer, analyst, and frequent guest Roger Annis. On this week's program, Ukraine's Plight, 4 years after Maidan, conversations with Ruslan Zarazov and Roger Annis. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 24th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. It's remarkable that whenever you read an article about Yemen in the mainstream media, the central role of Saudi Arabia and the United States in the tragedy is glossed over or completely ignored. A recent Washington Post article purporting to tell us how things got so bad explains to us that it's a complicated story, quote-unquote, involving warring regional superpowers, terrorism, oil, and an impending climate catastrophe. No, Washington Post, it's simpler than that. The tragedy in Yemen is the result of foreign military intervention in the internal affairs of that country. It started with the Arab Spring, which had all the fingerprints of State Department meddling, and it escalated with 2015's unprovoked Saudi attack on the country to reinstall Riyadh's preferred leader. That comes from the article, Why Are We Helping Saudi Arabia Destroy Yemen? By Representative Ron Paul, posted November 21st, originally appearing at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Interestingly, it was announced that any oil exporter who will accept payment in Chinese yuan will be able to convert them into gold at the Shanghai Gold Exchange and hedge the currency value of gold at the Shanghai Futures Exchange. That is why China needs physical gold, and it has been recently buying it on a large scale. Undoubtedly, all oil exporters, and especially those who have poor political relations with the USA, will profit from the segregation of the Chinese future market, because any decrease of US dollar influence diminishes seriously the ability of Washington to wage an economic war on select states. The introduction of the oil future traded in Chinese yuan will enable oil exporters, for example, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, to avoid sanctions on their oil trade. Thus, a plan is being commissioned to ruin the United States of America right before our eyes. That comes from the article, The Middle East, The Decline of American Might, by Victor Mikin, posted November 21st, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. As Common Dreams reported, quote, Trump's behavior throughout his campaign and presidency has heightened concerns about the threat of nuclear annihilation and has, for months, provoked global demands that the U.S. Congress strip Trump of his nuclear authority, unquote. While Hyten's comments on Saturday likely brought some relief to those concerned about Trump's finger on the nuclear button, Bruce Blair, a former nuclear missile launch officer and co-founder of the Global Zero Group that advocates eliminating nuclear weapons, said, there's another important caveat that shouldn't be missed. The Strategic Command Chief, Hyten in this case, could be bypassed by the president. A president can transmit his nuclear attack order directly to a Pentagon war room, Blair told the AP, and from there the news outlet reports the order, quote, would go to the men and women who would turn the launch keys, unquote. That comes from the article, Experts warn it would take more than one U.S. general to thwart illegal nuclear strike emanating from the White House. By John Queeley. Posted November 20th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. Israeli military intelligence-connected Debka file, or DF, discussed London media reports claiming Saudi King Salman intends naming Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman his successor in days, perhaps this week. DF quoted London's Daily Mail, saying the new monarch, once in power, intends, quote, starting a fire in Lebanon in the hope of Israeli military backing to crush Hezbollah, promising Israel billions of dollars if they agree, unquote. According to an unnamed source, the kingdom can't confront Hezbollah without Israeli help. Washington would have to agree. Israel won't attack Iran or Lebanon without U.S. permission and direct or indirect involvement, a huge risk likely involving Russia aiding Tehran like its Syria offensive against U.S. supported terrorists. That comes from the article U.S.-Saudi-Israeli Alliance for Greater Regional Turbulence by Stephen Lenman, posted November 20th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. It was 4 years ago this week, on November 21st, 2013, that Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych officially rejected an agreement on closer trade ties with the European Union, opting instead for closer cooperation with Russia. This event triggered the Euromaidan movement, which grew and overwhelmed the government's efforts to maintain control, ultimately resulting in the overthrow of the Yanukovych government in February of the following year, and a rash of violence that has shattered this former Soviet republic. In the months that would follow, Crimea would secede and rejoin Russia, and rebels in the southeast regions of Donetsk and Lugansk would engage in an armed rebellion, taking control of a series of cities. A ceasefire agreement, Minsk II, is in place with civilian monitors from OSCE countries monitoring and reporting on the situation. Currently, Ukraine's parliament, the Verkhova Rada, is deliberating over legislation that, once passed, possibly as soon as early December, will result in Russia being declared an aggressor country, the suspension of bilateral trade between Russia and Ukraine, and likely the resumption of military operations in the Donbass region. The U.S. Congress is considering providing lethal defense weapons to the Ukraine government as this program goes to air. To provide some in-depth historical context to the four-year-old Ukraine crisis, the Global Research NewsHour had the privilege of securing an interview with an authoritative voice on the subject. Ruslan Zarazov is a senior research fellow with the Central Institute of Economics and Mathematics of the Russian Academy of Sciences and head of the Department of Political Economy at Plekhanov, Russian University of Economics in Moscow. Zarazov has written extensively on the Russian Revolution as well as the distinctive form of capitalism that has emerged in post-communist Russia. In a talk he gave at the University of Manitoba in late September 2017, Zarazov evoked terms from the school of structuralist thought known as world systems theory, which postulate a set of relations of dependence among countries that undermine the development of the so-called peripheral capitalist countries at the expense of the more prosperous so-called core capitalist countries, such as the United States and Great Britain. Semi-peripheral capitalist countries sit in an intermediate phase between the two categories. In our interview, we started off with a discussion of the reasons for the failures of Russia and Ukraine to thrive as capitalist economies following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of communism. Here is Ruslan Zarazov.
The nature of peripheral capitalisms can be explained as shifting enormous portion of incomes created by its population in favor of transnational capital of the core. So from this perspective, the breakdown of the Soviet Union was an enormous tragedy for Soviet peoples, because they moved not to the capitalism of the core as they were persuaded by propaganda, as I mentioned already, but they shifted to periphery capitalism. That is at the, I think, at the root, this fact is at the root of all modern problems of the of current problems of the former Soviet societies. And Ukraine, I believe, demonstrates the classical features of peripheral capitalism, and it experienced enormous decline of production, while in Soviet times, Soviet Ukraine was one of the most prosperous Soviet republics, and now its manufacturing declined, even its agriculture declined, and the country suffers enormous decline of living standards, a capital flight, which was estimated by specialists from The Economist as amounting to 10% of the national wealth in nearly all post-Soviet years on average. And in result, the country lost, I think, its independence, which was the main reason why it split from the Soviet Union. Russia performs not much better. It also suffered enormous decline of manufacturing production and decline of living standards. However, Russia possesses large oil and gas resources. And in times of high prices on energy resources at the world market, Russia benefited from that. And this facilitated certain stabilization of economic and social situation in Russia and political situation. And I must say that comparing Russian and Ukraine capitalisms, many specialists believe that Russia occupies semi-peripheral position in the world capitalist system, which means that it, to a certain extent, it is able to defend its national interests. However, it also transfers a large portion of incomes created by its population in favor of transnational corporations. This happens primarily in the form of capital flight, which I think is less than 10% of national income annually, but still it is significant and it is persistent. It is enough to say that in 2014-15, when anti-Russian sanctions were imposed and there was enormous decline of oil prices and geopolitical conflict over Ukraine started, more than $200 billion of net outflow of private capital happened, which is enormous blow to Russian economy. However, Russia still has nuclear weapons, and it inherited from the Soviet Union education, fundamental science, and industrial potential. All this is eroded in post-communist times, but not to such extent that we can speak about complete peripheralization of Russia. So semi-peripheral status, I believe, is the legacy of the Soviet Union. So if we compare the two countries, I think we can perceive them as classical peripheral and semi-peripheral capitalism. And these are, I think, important preconditions, internal preconditions of these societies for the current geopolitical crisis.
The semi-peripheral country, having been able to survive the situation much better than the peripheral one.
I think so, yes. What is the most important is that semi-peripheral country, and all BRICS countries are semi-peripheral, they have more opportunities to defend their interests at the face of the capital of the core, while purely peripheral countries, they just subjugate and in fact sacrifice their national interests to the transnational capital of the core. That is the key difference.
Mm. When you look at the post-Maidan situation, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but all of the things that they were fighting for, they haven't achieved. And I don't see the Maidan protests. They're not that visible anymore. You're tracing this, their conception of how to go about achieving those goals. as being linked with a misunderstanding of the peripheral status of this country?
I think that at the core of Maidan protest was enormous and justified indignation of Ukrainian population with low living standards, corruption and inefficiency of the state, enormous social inequality, which is characteristic for both Russian and Ukrainian society. But I think for Ukrainian society, this problem is greater. And people were justified in their outrage about all this. However, these are inherent features of the peripheral capitalist system. And if you want to get rid of these features, you have to overcome the social foundations of this society. You have to move to some other type of capitalism. You have, or beyond capitalism, but in frameworks of peripheral capitalism, it is impossible to establish decent democracy, rule of law, achieve economic prosperity. Protesters naively believed that if they overthrow current government, which was corrupted and inefficient, they will achieve all their aims. In fact, since they result from the very foundations of the social system, it was impossible by changing the government. What is important is that this indignation of people was used, I believe, by external forces to achieve their aims, which were very different from what was pursued by rank and file participants of these events. And I mean foreign countries, first of all, United States of America and European Union, I believe facilitated Maidan uprising, supported right-wing opposition, which was present at the Maidan. I mean radical nationalist forces. I'm not saying that they formed overwhelming majority of protesters. According to some polls and estimations, they amounted to about 10% of participants on average. However, their presence was crucial because they were well organized. They had trained militants. Through their organization, Western countries, mainly United States, I believe, influenced events very much. And in fact, a violent coup in February 2014 was carried out using these militant groups as a real force, as a tool of changing power. And I would like to remind a famous saying of U.S. President Obama: we brokered transition of power in Ukraine. And Deputy State Secretary of United States Victoria Nuland made famous confession that United States spent $5 billion to strengthen democracy in Ukraine in post-Soviet period. In fact, if you take into account enormous scale of so-called non-government organizations, their activities in Ukraine all these years, then you will realize that it was much more than $5 billion, in fact. And if you take into account that major opposition political parties represented at Maidan were created with the help of the West, financially supported, and of course they were controlled by Western politicians, I mean Batkivshina with Yatsenyuk, who is a pro-American politician, I mean Udar with Klitschko, who is pro-German politician, and I mean Svoboda, headed by Tegnibok, who is obviously connected with Republican Party of United States and personally with McCain. So the West prepared Maidan event with the help of all these and many other elements of what we can call infrastructure of control over ostensibly, allegedly independent country. In fact, they exploited the features of peripheral capitalism. Of course, one of the key elements of Western influence in Ukrainian society were infamous oligarchs. We have the same problem in Russia, by the way. Oligarchs accumulate wealth in post-Soviet societies, but they keep it in the West. And due to that, they became dependent on the West. And the West can use them as a very powerful instrument of influence. And we saw it in Ukraine. Russia is also vulnerable for such misuse of dependence of its richest people on the West. In Ukraine, oligarchs supported and financed Maidan uprising, despite the fact that some of them were related and had close connections with Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine at the time. So all these different instruments of influence on Ukraine society were put to a good use, organizing Maidan uprising and then violent coup in February 2014, which ousted former President Yanukovych, however corrupted, he was legitimate president of Ukraine, and he was removed from power by force. And I would like to remind the famous leakage of discussions between Victoria Nuland, Deputy State Secretary of the United States, and U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Pyatt. He was ambassador at the time, who a few weeks, I think 3 or 4 weeks before change of power in Kiev, discussed who will be the next prime minister of this country. And they discarded Klitschko as pro-EU politician. They discarded Dagnybok as too extremist politician. And they came to a conclusion that Yatsenyuk is the...
Yats is our guy.
Yes, yes. Exactly. That pro-American politician, quite reliable, and he should lead the government. This happened a few weeks before Maidan triumphed and Yatsenyuk was put in power. So I think that these events, these dramatic events, on the one hand, were a result of democratic aspirations of Ukrainian people. On the other hand, they had shown limitations of bourgeois democratic movement in conditions of periphery capitalism. I think that real conditions, objective conditions of Ukrainian society in the framework of this type of social system, they simply provide no real opportunity to establish sound democracy, to fight corruption. That is why Maidan ideals failed, and the results, as you mentioned earlier, were very different from intended.
You mentioned in the among the Maidan who are seeking a more bourgeois democratic vision. Are we seeing anything fundamentally different in the southeast of Donbass starting to form?
Yes, I think that Donbass uprising is fundamentally different because it is a genuine uprising which was not organized, staged, facilitated, led by any external forces. And the real picture, I believe, is very different from what is depicted in the West. They depict Maidan uprising as coming only from people, as a grassroots, it is out of grassroots movement, while in Donbass everything was staged by Russia, by secret force, secret agencies, by Russian state and political parties. Trade unions were involved and such kind of things. I think that it is fundamentally false. If Donbass uprising was supported, really supported, organized and supported by Russia, then it would triumph not only in Donetsk and Lugansk oblasti, but in Kharkiv, Kherson, Odessa. But because in all these regions, there was enormous drive from below to against the new regime which took power in Kyiv. And I believe that failure of democratic aspirations of Maidan ignited Donbass uprising, because in result of Maidan events, nationalist, anti-Russian, and pro-American regime appeared. And since it was entrenching a periphery, fundamental features of peripheral capitalism in Ukraine, and since it was nationalistic, Russian and pro-Russian population of southeast of the country, it felt that it experienced both social and national oppression. One of the first, Russian and pro-Russian populations of the southeast lost its political representative representation in the capital in result of this coup. And one of the first acts of the new forces coming to power were to deprive Russian language of the status of the second official language in Ukraine. And today we see that now Kyiv government prohibits teaching in Russian in Ukrainian schools. So it was not any occasional and random event. This is one of the fundamental trends of the new regime to adopt anti-Russian policy and suppress pro-Russian population in Ukraine. And of course, this led to outrage of population, of pro-Russian population, and there were enormous riots, manifestations, demonstrations against new regime all over southeast in Crimea, Odessa, Kherson, Kyiv, Kharkov, Lugansk, Donetsk, and in everywhere, with the exception of Lugansk and Donetsk, these uprisings failed. However, in Kharkov, for example, there were more mass manifestations than in Donetsk. Kharkov is a greater city, and it is most important. Once it was a capital at the dawn of the Soviet power, it was a capital of Ukraine for some short time, a period of time. And Ukrainian state, new Ukrainian regime, focused on Kharkov, used all its resources to suppress uprising there, and that is how Donetsk and Lugansk succeeded, because they at the time they had no enough power to suppress popular uprising in all regions. But you remember that in Odessa there was very violent suppression of Odessa People's Republic, which was proclaimed, and pro-Russian activists were chased, and in their trade union's house there was a burning, and many people died and were burned alive. So all these, of course, led to military resistance, and reunification with Crimea, of Russia with Crimea, strengthened these sentiments in the southeast and facilitated Donetsk and Lugansk population to struggle for their independence.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. How do you see those international players aligning with those, the goals of the
you know, people on the ground that are, you know, trying to achieve some sort of democracy?
You know, to interpret the role of international players, we should take into account their interests. Why they were became interested supporting this coup. I believe that United States are very interested in using Russia to isolate China and to support their strategy in Eurasia, which was, according to American political thinkers, the main aim of U.S. strategy in Eurasia for the last century, was to prevent any superpower from arising there and uniting people and resources of the continent, because this would be a mortal threat for U.S. hegemony. And today, American ruling class is very concerned with the growth of China and with the challenge which this growth can present to U.S. domination. And they think that such countries as Russia should perform their function of semi-peripheries, in the sense that they should help transnational capital of the core to control periphery. And currently, Russia should help to isolate and subjugate China. Instead of this, of doing this, Russia last year, in 2000s, it launched its own Eurasian integration project, and it tried to play independent role in the international arena, and made a claim to become a regional power with the influence in the former Soviet Union, which doesn't fit the strategy of United States in Eurasia. And I think that this was the main reason why United States decided to broker this transition of power in Kiev, because Ukraine played a very important role in U.S. strategy to subjugate Russia. For instance, there was a plan to establish a third district of U.S. anti-missile defense system in Ukraine. Previously, Americans tried to organize this in Poland and Czechia, and Czech Republic. But now they decided to move it to Ukraine, and they needed overtly pro-American government in Kiev in order to organize this. And the other strategic move was to oust Russian fleet from the Black Sea, from Sevastopol, the major naval base of Russian Navy in the Black Sea, and replace it with U.S. Navy base. And these two, even only these two steps, were perceived by Russian government and ruling elite, by Russian society, as a mortal threat. And that is why Russian government decided to take preemptive steps, and it supported a popular uprising in Crimea, which was part of the uprising of the southeastern Ukraine, and they facilitated reunification with Crimea. So this was obviously a strategic move to defend vital interests of the country. And it completely coincided with aspirations of overwhelming population of Crimea. I think this was the first step of Russian state, which put a limit, which stopped unstoppable up to the time movement of NATO to the east. And of course, it inspired Southeast Asian, Southeast Ukrainian population to increase their uprising, because everybody believed that Russia will interfere and help Donetsk and Lugansk at the time. But this didn't happen. Russia, the position of Russian government is ambiguous in this issue. Russian government did not officially recognize Donetskaya and Luhanskaya People's Republics. And it provides only limited military and economic help. On the other hand, It was Russia, of course, who prevented military suppression of two breakaway republics in summer 2014. However, when pro-Russian troops in these two republics virtually defeated Ukrainian army, and it lost discipline and was unable to stop offense of these forces of two breakaway republics, Russian government stopped them. So it prevented extension of the republics to the boundaries of former Donetskaya and Luganskaya districts, and in fact these forces could go even further. On the other hand, Russian government prevented overgrowth of these movements for independence of two people's republics into something more, because from my personal communication with activists of these republics, with volunteers who went there to fight for their independence, I know that the overwhelming sentiment of people there was that property of oligarchs should be nationalized. National income should be redistributed in favor of workers, of hired labor. And genuine popular democracy should be established. Of course, the last term is controversial because different fractions of volunteers and activists understood different meaning under the term people's power. However, obviously, this was aspiration for wider democracy, for control or from below over the state, and in terms of nationalization and redistribution of wealth, there was unanimous decision that this should be done. Russian state prevented all that. You see, so on the one hand, Russia prevented military suppression of these republics. On the other hand, it leaves all possibilities for reconciliation with the West. Russian ruling elite is by no means determined to wage Cold War like Soviet Union, and it is demonized in the West.
It's interesting. So it's like they're not really, the ruling elite isn't trying to anymore to change the world situation, but maybe the
exactly.
way in which the West engages with them and with other countries.
Yes, I believe that people like Richard Sakwa from University of Kent, United Kingdom, they are correct when they argue that Russia pursues not revisionist but neo-revisionist course. It tries not to change the world order, but it wants to compel the West to recognize its interests in the framework of existing world order. I am not sure that it is realistic, but it is far cry from Cold War policy strategy of the Soviet Union, of course. And that is how we come to the nature of Minsky agreements, because these agreements are more in favor of Ukraine. I can remind that they were achieved in result of the offensive of two people's republics, in result of which Ukrainian army at the time was virtually swept away. And these accords, they fixed the new position, and according to these agreements, military forces of two republics stopped and had no right to go ahead. So at the time, these agreements were much more favorable for Ukrainian side. And obviously, this was an act of reconciliation on the part of Russian ruling elite. Russia, official Russia, signing or rather using its influence on breakaway republics and urging them to sign these agreements, suggested compromise to the West, but compromise was never achieved.
Contributing to our conversation with Ruslan Zarosov was Roger Annis, a past guest of our program. Annis is a Vancouver-based socialist writer and retired aerospace engineer. He spoke at the same conference as Zarosov, and we had him comment further on the role of the international community in Ukraine, including the role of Canada.
I would add a couple of points to all that he's described here. One is to underline the gravity of the economic situation in Ukraine. It's been something approaching an economic collapse in Ukraine since the Maidan coup, as I'll call it, in February 2014. Many factory closings, privatizations of previously state enterprises. Really, the only people that have benefited materially from this political change in Ukraine and the turn towards economic association with Europe have been some of the elite who've been able to sell off some of their holdings, or who have aspirations of becoming partners of European capital coming into Ukraine and investing, for example, in agriculture, which is by far now Ukraine's most valuable asset in the eyes of Western capitalist interests. But for workers, the loss of jobs, the loss of social security programs, the inflation, because the Ukrainian currency has, drastically lost value. It's been quite catastrophic. The other section of the population to benefit are the people who all along wanted, really didn't have that much interest in Ukraine itself. They want to be in Western Europe, and they want to go to Poland, to Czech Republic, to France, to Britain, to work where their economic prospects would be much better. And so there's been more free movement of labor westward, and the hoped for economic agreement, full integration of Ukraine into the European Union, which is not on the immediate agenda. But again, this hoped for integration with the European Union is driven in part quite strongly by those in Ukraine who foresee a future of not even living in Ukraine, but rather gaining access to the better living standards for them. The other thing I'd underline is just how unpopular is this government in Kyiv. The president, Petro Poroshenko, scores at around 10% of polling. There is deep dissatisfaction with the stagnation that people have lived in the last 3 years. So the only thing that really keeps this government alive is the continued anti-Russia propaganda, which appeals to a minority of the Ukrainian population, and the even smaller minority of the extreme right, which for now support the government in Kyiv because they're dependent upon it really for their own existence as well. But it's a pretty dire political situation as well. There's a stirring controversy with Russia and the West, for that matter, with an idea that's been floated for some time by Petro Poroshenko of having United Nations peacekeepers come into eastern Ukraine. It's a mess, and really the only thing that keeps this Ukrainian regime alive and afloat in Kyiv is its Western backing and this, torrent of anti-Russia abuse, distortion of history, to which a minority of the population adheres. The only thing I could say about Canadian policy is it's very much in lockstep with the United States and also with Great Britain. The three countries have troops in Ukraine. Until this year, those troops were restricted to training activities in Western Ukraine, and then the people they train would go off and terrorize the population of Eastern Ukraine. But now these troops have more freedom of they've been given freedom of movement to actually be in the zone of Eastern Ukraine. So it's a very dangerous escalation. The other very serious escalation and provocation by Canada specifically is that Canada has lifted restrictions which previously prevented the sales of arms to Ukraine. Now they've lifted provisions on some of the lighter weaponry making it possible for Ukraine to purchase weapons from Canada. That's a very serious escalation that has typically gotten scant attention in the mainstream media in Canada.
On this point of UN peacekeeper, the proposition to bring in UN peacekeepers, Russians have had a kind of a counter proposal to that, and I was wondering if you, Ruslan, would like to comment on what specifically Russia is putting in place, and you know their motivations.
You know, this issue is debated for a long time, from very beginning of the conflict, when the Kyiv regime realized that it has not enough military resources to suppress two republics, they decided to involve Western countries as much as they can. And one of the attempts was to introduce UN peacekeepers there. They think that if peacekeepers go there, then they will be mostly pro-Ukrainian, and they will help to control the area. There will be international military forces with weapons, and they will support the position of European monitoring missions there, which usually are very strict to violations of Minsk agreements on the part of the military forces of breakaway republics, but they are blind to much greater violations and to systematic provocations undertaken by Ukrainian militaries in the region.
Sounds like the same model they have in Haiti, where in UN have been...
Yes, and in many other countries. And in the former Soviet space as well, for instance, in the southern Caucasus prior to this so-called five-day war of 2008. So this is the methodology of supporting a Western ally in a conflict with in a military conflict which came to an impasse. Western countries, especially United States, accumulated great experience how to do that, and they applied all range of these instruments, for instance, during the Balkan crisis in the 1990s. They stopped offensive of People's Republics using Minsk agreements, and now they create certain infrastructure of control over this military conflict, which will be favorable for their ally. And UN peacekeepers are part of this plan. That is why Russia was always opposing that. This created conditions for depicting Russian position as uncooperative, aggressive. Look, we want to stop military actions, and they won't prevent this from happening. That is why I think so. Russian government changed its position now and put forward another diplomatic initiative, and they devised the conditions on which they agree to partial presence of UN peacekeepers in the region.
I was actually very interested in hearing what Ruslan just said now about the Minsk agreement, because I've always presented it in favorable terms, and I think that's still correct to do so. And I'm glad he's underlined how unfavorable the Minsk II agreement was for the fairly limited objectives of the Donbass uprising, which, let's remember, in its origin was an uprising not for an independent Donbass, and certainly not for federation with Russia, but rather for autonomous republics in Donetsk and in Lugansk that would have political powers roughly corresponding to the powers of provincial governments in Canada or state governments in the United States. And even that, the Ukrainian government was unwilling to accept, and I believe the European Union unwilling to accept also, even if they hypocritically talk as being supporters of Minsk too. But that said, it was some months after Minsk II when Ukraine has refused to implement the terms of it that Poroshenko began to talk about UN peacekeepers. And this is really an end run around the situation. That is, he wants to get a military and political force that's largely controlled by the West into eastern Ukraine, and then just step by step reassert Ukraine's authority in the region. And I think it's brilliant what the Russian government has responded with, which is, number one, the Minsk II agreements remain the priority. And any UN presence in eastern Ukraine would be conditional on the implementation of Minsk II. And they've said there must be a withdrawal of heavy weaponry from the contact line that runs the ceasefire line, shall we go? It's not a ceasefire. Contact line that runs through the middle of Donetsk and Lugansk, so there must be a withdrawal of heavy weaponry, which was in Minsk II agreement originally, and Ukraine has refused to implement. And number two, the UN forces cannot be on the Ukrainian-Russian border. And so the ball is back in Ukraine's court now and in the West's court. And I think what the Russian proposal helps to do, given that we have a total media blockade on what the real situation is in eastern Ukraine, on what the real Minsk II agreement actually says, I think it's quite helpful for shedding some light on who's really responsible for the failure of any long-standing ceasefire agreement to be established. So, you know, hats off to Russian diplomacy on this one. The ball's back in the West's court now. Are you willing to have the Minsk II agreements implemented with UN peacekeepers along the contact line to make sure that Ukraine doesn't continue shelling Donetsk and Lugansk? Well, I predict that the West will not accept the Russian proposal because they've shown no interest in a ceasefire, unfortunately, sadly, and tragically. I've been on the contact line in eastern Ukraine, and I know how tragic life is for the people who don't have means to move and get out of the line of fire of the Ukraine armed forces, and that's mostly the older people. Because they're not going to go live in refugee shelters. All they have is in their apartments there, you know, that run through the western districts of Donetsk City and all along that line. It's really tragic, and the world really should be looking into this and really should be pressuring Ukraine and the West to implement a meaningful ceasefire. And I fear that there's still not yet enough pressure by the citizenry in the West, in the Western countries, to compel their governments to accept that there should be a peace and a political settlement in eastern Ukraine. I'm sad to say it, but I think we're still not yet there in terms of awareness and in pressure coming from the West, such that the Western governments and the government in Kiev act correspondingly.
Is a de facto division of Ukraine inevitable, or are we going to see 5 years from now, is this contest going to continue? Where is all this leading?
I think that now returning to Ukraine in the former borders as it was to the moment of breakdown of the Soviet Union is impossible. Because too many things changed, and this civil war which Kyiv regime started, it eliminates any opportunity to return to a former compromise between two parts of Ukraine. So Ukraine is doomed to be split in a few countries. How many parts will be... how many countries will appear at the place of Ukraine? We don't know, because there is another question of Uzhgorod, so-called Zakarpattia, where there are big national minorities of other people, for instance, Hungarians, who are not happy with having neo-Banderovtsy in power in Kyiv. Bandera was leader of Ukrainian collaborators with Nazi during the Second World War. So I think that return to status quo is already impossible. I think that Ukrainian economy is in a ruined state, and it depends on finances from the West, on Western credits, and if these credits stop, then there will be no other means to stop disintegration of the country. And, of course, all depends on military activities. Currently, United States are bogged in Syrian crisis, and it seems that they have not enough resources to support Kyiv regime in its attempts to crash the People's Republics. If they find such resources, then situation can deteriorate dramatically. If not, then People's Republics will survive, and nobody knows what will happen in 5 years. I can't predict it exactly. The only thing which I believe is certain is that status quo is impossible anymore.
Roger Annis, what is your crystal ball telling you?
The crystal ball is very hazy. I mean, let's remember that the original goal of the counter-Maidan protests was a federal Ukraine, a Ukraine in which there would be a decentralization of power. People in the West forget Ukraine is a highly centralized country. Imagine a Canada where all the governing authority is in Ottawa, none in Winnipeg, none in Vancouver, none in Toronto, or in any of the other provincial capitals. That's the Ukraine. And, you know, that existed for 25 years and people weren't so happy, and then it blew up with a Maidan coup. And so a decentralized Ukraine, I think, is unavoidable. It's a fundamental part of of any resolution. In that context, whether now, as Ruslan has said, after 3 years of cruel civil war, the people in Donbass specifically would be prepared to accept that, or instead whether they would strive for an outright independence or perhaps even a federation with Russia, that's a question. But we're still a long way from a substantive political settlement in Ukraine, so we can only speculate on Donbass. Two other things that I would watch for is, you know, anytime the Ukrainian government takes, you know, another right-wing step, like it's done with the new language law that's lifting the rights of education and minority languages, well, the Hungarian government has said that this obliges them to block Ukraine's application to the European Union. So these and similar measures, provocative measures, I would say, that reflect the extreme nationalism that's in power in Kyiv will be factors. And then thirdly, developments in Europe. Were the Labour Party in Britain to be elected, would that, you know, cause a new British government to withdraw its troops from Ukraine? That would be a very positive thing. I don't see something similar like that happening in Canada that would lead Canada to withdrawing its troops. But I seriously hope for political changes in Europe that would bring more left-wing governments into power that could change Europe being so tightly allied with the United States in its anti-Russia policy, with all the implications for Ukraine. So those are three possibilities. And, you know, I don't see a lot of immediate movement on any of those right now. So, you know, in the short run, you know, things don't look too good. I can only hope that, you know, some unforeseen developments, such as a growing dissatisfaction by the Ukrainian people themselves, could really start to change things in a much bigger way. I'm hopeful for the future in the long run, because the demands of the pro-autonomy movement, shall we say, in Ukraine are eminently reasonable, eminently obtainable. That gives me a lot of hope, but in the short run, when I look at who's running the West and who's running the government in Ukraine, there's not a lot of hope in the short term. So we can only hope and anticipate for improvements, and the sooner the better.
That conversation with Ruslan Zarasov and Roger Annis was recorded in Winnipeg at the Fort Garry Hotel on October 2nd, 2017. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week. Thank you.